Good afternoon.
Hey, sir.
How you doing?
Good.
Want to welcome everyone this afternoon to the Joint Justice and Public Safety Oversight Committee. Today, the 10th of October in room 643. Our House Sergeant of Arms are Garland Shepherd and Larry Elliott. Our Senate Sergeant of Arms, we have four, Ashley Mickens. There she is. All right. You the one told me we're running overtime. Ed Kiesler, Canton Lewis, and Billy Fletcher. Thank you. Evidently, it takes more sergeants of arms to oversee the Senate that is present here than the House.
Well, I require a lot of protection.
Good. Glad to have everyone here. Before we get into the opening remarks by chairs, I would like, this is our first Oversight Committee meeting. If we could start with the Senate. We'll start with Senator Woodard, and we'll go around, introduce yourselves, and what district.
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Woodard. I represent Senate District 22, Durham, Person, and Caswell counties.
No, thank you.
Warren Daniel, District 46, Burke and Cleveland County.
Mike Speciale, House District 3, Craven, Pamlico, and Beaufort counties.
Jonathan Jordan, House District 93, Asham, Watauga counties.
Josh Dobson, 85th District, Avery Mitchell and McDowell.
Rena Turner, District 84, Iredell County.
Sarah Stevens, District 90, all of Surrey County and a little bit of Wilkes.
Charles Graham, District 47, Robinson County.
John Faircloth, District 61, Guilford County.
Leo Daughtry, District 26, Johnston County.
Justin Burr, District 67, Stanley and Montgomery Counties.
Austin Allren, Catawba, Alexander.
Tom Goolsby, District 9, New Hanover County, which is Wilmington, Curry Beach, Carolina Beach, and Wrightsville Beach.
We got Senator here?
I already went.
Okay, thank you. I was checking in with my boss. At this time, we're also going to ask the staff if they would introduce themselves.
Hal Pell, Research Division, Staff Attorney.
Susan Seitz, Research Division.
William Childs, Fiscal Research Division.
Lisa Fox, Fiscal Research Division.
John Petit, Fiscal Research.
Christine Leggett, Fiscal Research.
Emily Johnson, Bill Drafting Division.
Sean Dale, Bill Drafting Division.
Thank you, as far as the staff. At this time, I'd like to ask our chairs if you'd like to have any opening remarks or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Pat Hurley from Randolph County. I just have a small portion, Archdale Trinity, Ashboro, Randleman, home of Richard Petty, and Level Cross. So I'm lucky there. I'm glad to welcome you to our first meeting, and we're looking forward to learning more about what we do and have an oversight. And we've got a bunch of changes, and we're looking forward to hearing from each of you today. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. I'm Tom Goolsby. Just introduced myself from Wilmington. I was oversight chair last time, and it's a pleasure to be back to be an oversight chair again. Good to see Senator Newton, who's, of course, one of the JPS appropriations chairs with us. And I look forward to what we did last time in this committee, and that is looking for the reports that come in that we put in legislation to be generated. talking with folks from different state agencies and others. I would very much encourage the members, the public, the government relations folks who are here, things that you would like us to look into. I am all ears. I know that Jamie and Pat are the same way. We want to make sure that we fully utilize this committee. This is extremely important. This is justice and public safety, law enforcement, prisons, our DAs, everybody across the state, all the law enforcement functions deserve us to be looking into the important issues of the people during this interim period. That is our job. That's what we're here for. That's why we're spending the people's money to bring all of us up here. And I want to make sure that this is a good use of the taxpayer dollars and that we do not waste our time up here. So please, please send the chairs any and all suggestions. Joseph is my committee clerk. He works for me full time. And we will do everything we can to address those in here and to deal with important things that are for the safety of the people of North Carolina. So it's my pleasure to be back, and I look forward to another good interim committee working on justice and public safety. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Also this time, we've had a Senator Newton come in. If you'd like to introduce yourself, what district and counties?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I represent District 11, which is Wilson, Nash, and Johnston counties, or parts of those counties. And it's a pleasure to be back on this committee and working with you guys again. We'll stay on top of it. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time also, I'd like to introduce, we have our committee staff with Mr. Brooks and Ms. Jennings are here. And... okay. And Ms. Mobley came in. How you doing? If you'd like to introduce yourself and what district and counties you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Andy Mobley from, I reside in Hertford County, represent the 5th District made up of Hertford, Bertie, Gates, and a portion of Pasquotank County that I haven't learned exactly where the lines are, but I feel safe in saying the city of Elizabeth City.
Good. Thank you. And I'd like to especially welcome and also thank our clerks, Carrie Geis, Deborah Holder, and Joseph Kaiser. As you all know, they do the real work, and we just get up here and look nice. So, but I would especially like to thank Carrie for all she's done and what she's doing. Also, I would like to thank the Adult Corrections DPS yesterday for a tour of the Women's Central Prison. Those that attended, I think you, like myself, found it to be very enlightening and very educational, and we have some very committed staff members and correctional officers over there, and I was just real impressed with the tour that we had, and hopefully this committee, we've set up tours, can set up other tours of the facilities, and if you have an interest of anything in particular, please let the chairs know, and we'll try to facilitate things for you. At this time, I'd like to recognize Hal Pell with the Research Division with the committee charge, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, has in front of them some statutes that are in their folder, Article 12J. These first couple of statutes talk about the creation, membership, and organization of the committee. I'll just highlight the provisions in 120-70.94 as far as the purpose and the powers of the committee. To examine on a continuing basis the correctional law enforcement and juvenile justice systems in order to make recommendations to the General Assembly, to study the budget, programs, and policies of the Department of Public Safety, to study the effectiveness of the Department of Public Safety in implementing its duties and responsibilities, to examine the effectiveness of the Division of Juvenile Justice in implementing its duties and responsibilities, and study the needs of juveniles, including child welfare services, juvenile court system, and services provided by the Department of Health and Human Services. Also to study and evaluate domestic violence programs, funding, law enforcement response to domestic violence, legal services for domestic violence, and to review conviction data collected on domestic violence cases. I would note that in 2005, the Joint Legislative Committee on Domestic Violence was created and pursued these duties and responsibilities until 2011, when those duties of the Domestic Violence Committee were transferred to this committee to undertake. The committee may also consider any other matter that the committee deems necessary. So it's rather a broad charge to the committee. I will only briefly touch on some of the specific powers are referenced in the statute concerning powers of a joint committee, and those are to request all information and data in the possession or ascertainable in the records from all officers, agents, agencies, and departments of the state. So this committee does have that authority and may use a subpoena power if necessary to compel either testimony or the production of documents. It also has the power to seek an order from the Superior Court if a witness or a party or entity refuses to testify or provide information to show why the person should not be held in civil contempt of court. And that would be a proceeding in Superior Court. And this committee has the same power with regard to persons who might disrupt the committee's proceedings to seek a order of civil contempt from Superior Court. Mr. Chair, that's all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Pell. Any questions from the committee as we move forward? With none, we'll move forward to our I've asked for a Viper update, and I think we have Mr. Mike Hodgkins with Viper System Manager with the State Highway Patrol Department of Public Safety will come and make a presentation. I think you have the handouts in your booklets, and we'll follow through.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Chair, thank you very much, members of the committee. My name is Mike Hodgson from the State Highway Patrol. We're going to give you a very brief update on the status of the Viper system. Obviously, last session you were gracious enough to provide us some funding, and we want to give you a report back on that and our progress. Viper, Voice Interoperability Plan for Emergency Responders, came before the legislature back in 2004 for approval, and we have continued to work forward with that plan. Just a brief overview for you. It is a statewide 800 megahertz radio system. It's there for all emergency responders at all levels of government. Federal, state, local involvement in it. We have 37 counties that use the system as their primary radio system today. The goal is to be able to take a 3-watt portable radio device and work in 95% of the state. Network infrastructure is basically radio towers, which are connected together with a microwave radio system. We do that independently of any carrier to ensure that we're able to maintain that system in the times of need or disaster, etc. And the implementation, operations, and maintenance of that system was tasked to the North Carolina Highway Patrol to provide. If you're an agency that wishes to join the system, the requirement for you is simply to purchase an end-user device, a radio, mobile, portable, or base station to use in your facility or your counties to join the network. There are 241 sites currently planned to be statewide or provide the statewide coverage to the 44,000 square miles of North Carolina. 202 of those sites are operational today. We have 16 sites already under construction that are funded, and 27 sites remain to be funded and constructed. Now, just to clarify for you, you have legislation in place beginning in the 2014-15 fiscal year to provide $7 million of funding a year, allowing us to continue to build those sites, but obviously that funding is not in place until next year, so we show that that funding this year is unfunded. Viper is 84% complete with the 202 sites that we have operational. Today we have 65,388 users on the system, mobiles, portables, base stations across all the disciplines. 260 end-user agencies use it. Obviously, the state's resources, State Highway Patrol, Alcohol Law Enforcement, Wildlife Resources Commission, Emergency Management, et cetera, use the system every day. Obviously, the system's primary goal is improving interoperability. Interoperability is defined as the ability for people from different disciplines, different agencies, to be able to communicate together effectively in day-to-day or emergency situations. And interoperability really was a buzzword that came out of 9/11. The 9/11 Twin Tower collapse proved that that was an important component in the after-action reports. We unfortunately have about 3,174 users as of earlier this week when this slide presentation was put together that would like to join the network. And in order to do that, we've got to make some steps on advancements in technology to increase the number of users we can add to the system. We are at the maximum number today with the 65,388 that we have on the system. And we'll talk about that just a little bit more in a second. To do that, we need to go to a new standard. A new digital standard called P25 or Project 25 is part of the American Public Safety Communications Officials APCO standard for digital communication systems, and that is the direction that we are moving VIPER. That is what you provided $25 million funding for this fiscal year for us to achieve. In order to do that, we have three significant tasks that need to occur, which have been, in some cases, ongoing, and others began once the funding was implemented into the patrol's VIPER budget. The first one, programming and radio reconfiguration, tower upgrades, and overall project timeline and completion will be items that we discussed this morning. Programming of radios. For every one of the 65,000 user devices on the system, we must reprogram that radio and make it ready for the P25 conversion. So a new set of firmware or software, however you want to look at it, has to be loaded into that radio to ensure that the radio is operating on the current technology as well as the new technology as we move forward. We have completed that in the western half of the state and are working in the eastern half of the state to do that now, and the target for that reprogramming effort to be complete is the end of December of this year. We cannot do the conversion of the infrastructure until that completion of reprogramming is done. Once that's done, we've checked off one of the components that allows us to move forward. The second biggest piece of the process of getting to P25 is to improve our connectivity. I mentioned earlier that microwave radio or microwave on the towers is what provides us connectivity. If you look at the towers that we have and you're at all familiar with those, this is basically a really big dish that sits on the tower, and they are used to connect the towers down the line to each other. We do not have wires buried in the ground that we rent from a carrier or connect. Everything is done via microwave. It tends to be much more reliable and can't be dug up by a backhoe and things like that. In order to make the connections for P25, we need more capacity. Just as we need capacity to add users, we also need capacity in our microwave system. And of the sites we have today, the 202, 52 of those sites need to have some structural modifications done before we can add additional microwave dishes to the towers. We are in the process of making those upgrades. We have 18 of those underway, but like I say, there are 52 that have to have that upgrade done before we can get to the goal of actually migrating the infrastructure. You see some locations there, Newton, Ashborough, Staley, Salisbury, et cetera, that are underway now. That is dependent upon the P25 migration is dependent on the reprogramming and the completion of the work of those 52 towers. The goal, based on the funding, is to be complete within the funding's time frame, which is 1 year beginning July 1 and ending June 30th, 2014, and we will have converted the system no later than June 30th of next year. As I mentioned earlier, a lot of questions come to us frequently about how are you coming with new tower construction. For the people in the areas of the state, predominantly the western part of the state, we are still building towers and improving our coverage in the west. Beginning the 2014-15 budget, there is a $7 million recurring appropriation to allow us to continue to build those tower sites in the west, predominantly in the west. There are very, very few left to construct in the eastern Piedmont area of the state. Just an eye chart for those of you who can see it better up here or in the presentation you have. This essentially illustrates the coverage that we have as of May 7, 2013, when the last site was activated and this map was redrawn. Yellow and blue are good. As you can see in the western part of the state, there are some areas where there is no yellow and no blue. Those are the areas where we continue to build tower sites out. And as I mentioned earlier, this is all based on a 3-watt handheld device being used by the emergency responder. If you have any questions, Captain James Blanks is our unit commander within the Technical Services Unit of the Highway Patrol, my supervisor. Here is an email address. You're welcome to contact him. It certainly gets to us. There's also our 800 Network Operations Center. As part of, I mentioned, the patrol provides the operations and maintenance of Viper. We have a 24-hour center that's staffed, that monitors the health of the system, all of the generators, air conditioners, and everything that is part of this system is monitored 24 hours a day, and there is a contact number for that as well. This basically concludes my presentation, but Mr. Chair, any questions that anybody may have, I'll be happy to try and answer those for you at this time.
At this time, Representative McNeil, I think I saw your hand go up first.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. With this P25 upgrade, what will that ceiling be raised to as far as number of users?
128,000. So we almost double the capacity of the system by going to the new technology.
Thank you.
Follow up, you're okay.
I did have one additional question, if I can ask it now.
Right. We're here all day. We're going to try to beat the 9-hour meeting from the other day.
All right. That's great. as far as the reprogramming that you said is necessary with the P25 upgrade, are the individual agencies, cities and counties, are they capable of doing that reprogramming themselves, or do you have to have hands-on from your people?
Initially, we factored that into our cost of getting there. So once the programming has been completed one time and basically that new load of software is done, the counties do a lot of the programming themselves. We've held trainings over the past 3 years in which representatives from every one of the counties has attended, received the necessary equipment to be able to do that. However, as an initial start with P25, we wanted to make sure that there was a uniformity across the entire state and all the units, so that was included as part of our initial rollout. And then once that's done, there'll be an opportunity to make changes. At some point in time, we have to take the old programming out, and we're hoping that a lot of the counties will want to do that themselves to gain additional experience and work through that.
Sure.
One additional follow-up, if I may.
And I'd like to follow.
Yeah.
So the Highway Patrol is going to do the initial P25 installation of all radios?
Yes, sir. In the initial funding, there was a provision made to allow for the initial programming to be done across all the radios. However, beyond that, the counties will have the opportunity to make future changes themselves.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just had one last follow-up. And I know you don't have this information right now, but I'd like to know what the cost of maintaining the system's going to be, and I know you may or may not have it now.
We have a very good number in hand. The target goal is about $7.5 million a year, counting salaries, maintenance, fuel, repairs, everything that goes into that factor. Last year in the July 1 legislative increase, we went up 2.625, I believe it was, or $2.5 million additionally. And there's already a provision in the legislation that once we complete the tower construction, that the recurring funding that you set aside effective July 1, 2014, will reduce to close the gap between what our annual appropriation for repairing maintenance is today and to complete out that $7.5 million target. So we have the funding at least in play, we'll say, to make sure that that recurring maintenance need is met. And that is a huge thing, and I think certainly I thank you for the construction money to get us to P25, but also from a standpoint of maintaining what we have. You know, we've not always done a good job of funding the maintenance, and I think last year's legislation set the stage for that, and I certainly say thank you because it makes my job a lot easier.
Okay, I have Representative Faircloth and Representative Stevens. Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hodgson, I appreciate the presentation. Without giving any bad guys ideas, every system has vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking in terms of man-caused vulnerabilities and also weather and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples of what might be something we could suffer and how would we react to it?
Right. Unfortunately, you know, hardening things to a point is either cost prohibitive or can you really defend against anything that someone may throw at you? You know, as a general rule, Mother Nature is probably our worst enemy. Wind or structural damage could occur as a result of catastrophic weather, but you're certainly right, Representative, that you could go blow up a site or do some damage to a site that's man-made, you know, a human intervention for that. The good news from our perspective is A, we don't build the sites without some overlap. So we would hope that they won't target a whole area. They'll target one, and then we can, you know, look at protecting the rest of them if it takes people to go and, you know, watchdog or watch guard over them. But indeed, if we lose one, there is some overlapping coverage to accommodate the fact we've lost a site. We also have redundancy in the way we construct that interconnect or that connectivity via our microwave system. We go at it from multiple directions. So you may have a path that comes from this way or this way to the same site, and if you lost a site, you know, you would be able to sustain your overall network. And that's one of the things in the money that you gave us for P25, that is one of the tasks that we made sure that we addressed even more so, making sure that we are able to maintain the network and the sustainability using the dollars provided to take that into consideration as well. So part of that upgrade to P25 looks at how do we make sure that we don't have a total loss of a piece of the state if we had a catastrophic, either man-made or weather-related event. So there's no perfect answer to that. I wish there was, you know, but unless you build a wall around it as tall as a tower, you're not going to be able to protect it entirely, and then somebody would blow the wall up and then blow the tower up on top of it. So it's unfortunate we have to look at that, but I think we try to do that as best as possible.
Follow up. I want, on behalf of the citizens of North Carolina and the law enforcement agencies and other public service agencies, I want to thank you folks for the interest you have, the hard work you're doing, what you've done in the past, what you've worked with us on to make things work in the future. This is vital to our safety and well-being in this state, and I commend you for it.
Thank you, Representative, for the comments.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is we have 5% of the state that doesn't have the even at our goal. 5% of the in-street portable coverage will not be there. Where exactly is that, and what are we doing for them?
Well, the bottom line is it goes back to can you build 100%? And I think the goal is to say what was a reasonable achievement set to provide that coverage. So if you look at it from the perspective of what does 99.99999% cost us, you know, the model goes up exponentially. Where is the 5%? Man, that's going to be one of those situations that someone's going to have to go and find. Hey, I went and stood out here, and it didn't work, and I moved 3 foot to the left, and it did, or 3 foot to the right, and it didn't. You know, the map that we produce is relatively conservative. in that it looks at, hey, where is the theoretical hole? But in many cases, you go and stand in that hole, and it works. So even the map itself is not the best tool. And one of the things that early on people said, well, you're the highway patrol, and you've built this system to be 95% portable in the street. So does that mean the trooper stands in the middle of the highway to define your 95%? No, it really means that you're outside. And unfortunately, really not knowing who was willing to join the system. If you go back to 2004, some people usually ask us, why didn't you build the system to be 95% portable in a building? Well, define what the parameters of the building is. Is it a jail or a single-story wood frame house in a rural setting? I mean, that those are all different variables, and not knowing how to build that is difficult. One of the things I will tell you is over time, cities and counties have joined the system. We'll use more. Representative Bowles' area wants to join the system, and they are willing to front the cost to improve the coverage beyond what we, the state, define the coverage to be. So if their counties are willing to say, I want to use VIPER, I recognize that the cost of investment for the county to build my own system is here. Joining VIPER costs me here, even if I make some improvements to the system, that's still a cost benefit to the taxpayers and gets me what I want. The coverage may now be 98% portable in the street. So we had to set a baseline, and I think it's difficult to measure until you literally go out there real time and say, I took this device and it did or did not meet my expectations. I will tell you, thankfully, as a general rule, if you take that map and you say, I think this is a white dot where there's not supposed to be coverage, 9 times out of 10, there really is. So I think we have built it perhaps a little better than we portrayed, but we set a goal and had to try to set something to work towards.
Thank you. Representative McNeil?
Yeah, thank you. I got one final question. Mm-hmm. I noticed in reading your quarterly report that you are getting some federal funds to build towers.
Correct.
Exactly how much is the federal government pitching in, and what are you using that money for?
If you look at the original budget for VIPER, which was a little over $189 million in capital costs, I believe to date we have about $109 million of that funded from federal funds. The dilemma we have with federal dollars right now, and unfortunately it's almost a negative impact, and that is that as the federal government has gone on further and further with its grant funds, they have squeezed harder. They have said that the timeline to complete projects is shorter and shorter and shorter. And the other thing we have as a huge hurdle using federal dollars is that we have an environmental review process that we have to go through with the federal government. That typically involves, when we do a tower construction project, and that's really what it is, a construction project, we have to go through all these hoops. We have to go through this environmental review, et cetera, et cetera. And instead of that being reviewed at the state level, state construction and state historic preservation, it goes to FEMA Region 4 in Atlanta. The average turnaround time from FEMA Region 4 is 22 months. Now, believe it or not, the average grant performance period from the federal government is 3 years. Now, we get the money. We go out there and do the review and the planning and produce a document that we now send to FEMA, and 22 months later we get it back. We'll never get it built before the federal funds run out. And one of the things that has unfortunately happened, I think it's through no fault of North Carolina's, and Director Sprayberry, I look to him to say yes or no, it's not through a lack of effort to spend the money, but when they don't give you an extension to your grant, when the money runs out, game over. The money's run out. You can't continue that project. And in some cases, that now causes us to fall back on state funds again for a project that may have been originally funded through federal dollars. Now, the flip side of that is federal dollars are diminishing tremendously. In 2004, this program received in excess of $30 million in federal funds towards VIPER. I think last year we did about $1.5 million or thereabouts dollars towards the program, only because North Carolina's amount of money we receive every year has gone from $50 million to $5 million. So VIPER continues to receive a significant portion of that. It's just the amount of money that's available for the program, North Carolina, to spend on any program through Homeland Security has diminished tremendously, and then we have to be able to spend it in the time, the grant performance period, and that's another challenge that, unfortunately, in some cases, isn't achievable.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondered, there was a big concern about the western part of the state, the mountains, about the communications there. How is that being worked out?
Well, obviously the mountains presents a huge geographic challenge. Not saying that the other parts of the state doesn't, but building the towers in the mountains has issues just from getting it done and then also covering it. But that's really where the focus is for the remainder of the sites. Most of the sites that are under construction now and the ones to be funded are west of I-77. You know, I realize the mountains goes all the way to Murphy, but most of that new construction is west of I-77 and in the mountain counties. Originally, the state was to work from one end to the other. When we started using federal funds, a local recipient had to be found for that, so we kind of jumped around a lot more over the map, but now that we're using state appropriated funds, we're pushing on, and the goal is to try and finish the West.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One other question came to mind. Can you give some opinion as to what satellite communications might hold for public safety in the future?
We have used satellite communications in North Carolina. I know State Emergency Management provided them to each county in the event of a loss of a terrestrial-based or land-based system. The biggest thing there is A, cost, and B, capacity in terms of the number of conversations that you can hold simultaneously using the satellite. Is it a replacement for VIPER? Should we use satellite instead of VIPER? If you look at the 50 states and say, how do they do it, is satellite a component in our toolbox? I kind of like to look at things and say, hey, what's in our toolbox? We have this. It's part of our program. We use it to communicate with the federal government. But as far as the day-to-day, a small device that works between the emergency responders, it's not really necessarily a practical tool. One of the biggest factors is a satellite device doesn't work inside of a building. Can't see the sky, no longer an effective tool. So I think the issue there is across the board, what we do now, towers, et cetera, provides the best overall platform for us, but certainly satellite is a tool that we have in the toolbox.
Now, was that a VIPER or satellite interference?
I'm not sure. A bad violin player, maybe.
Any other question amongst the members? I have a question. You had mentioned that you had $7 million in 2014 in maintenance, and did I understand, and to build out additional towers? Did that include building and maintenance, or? Okay, if we can go over that one more time, please.
Yes, sir. To clarify that, the way the legislation, I believe, is written is starting in 2014, there is a $7 million appropriation for the construction of towers. Once we complete that construction, the amount of money necessary between the amount we currently receive for operations and maintenance, which is about $5.6 million total, the balance of that would come from a reduction in the appropriation down to that necessary to bring us in line with the $7.5 million number that we've projected to the legislature. Does that, am I clear on that?
Right, so 14, there's $12 million, 5 to maintenance and 7 to construction.
Mr. Chair, Yes, that's correct. You currently appropriate 2.5, and in the past budget, you gave them an additional 2.8 for operation and maintenance, which brings it up to 5.2. And then in the second year of the biennium, you've appropriated $7 million recurring that is going to be used for tower construction. That is a 3 or 4 year process. Once that tower construction is done, y'all can come back, the appropriations committee can come back and reduce that $7 million to 2 or 3 or however much they're going to need in additional funding for operation, and they'll be fully funded for operation and maintenance.
Okay, thank you. One other question. I got two others. Are all state agencies on the Viper or using Viper?
I guess the answer to that is all of the traditional public safety agencies are. Not in their entirety, because the ID limitation has held up many of them. I know DOT and I think the North Carolina Forest Service would like to move more to that, but the ID issue has prevented that. I mean, to go down a list of every state agency and say they have a Viper radio, I think the answer is no, they're not.
Okay. And if you did go to DOT and as an example, that would reduce the eligibility capacity to municipality, law enforcement, or county public safety?
Yes, sir, it would.
Okay. All right. And wait a minute, Alan, I got one more. More counties got radios. When do you anticipate that Moore County, or in a county like Moore County that already has the towers, the cones, the radios, but we don't have P25, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And your statement was that the State Highway Patrol would come in and put the P25s in, and that after that, then the county can maintain its own program.
Correct. Once the programming is done initially to provide a P25, we call it a code plug, but essentially it's the P25 programming in the radios. Once that's done and the infrastructure has moved to P25, now the ID problem goes away. Now we go from 65 to 128,000, and hopefully I'll be retired when we get to 128,000.
Oh, no. So, not until we get P26 put in.
That's right. The goal is on or before June 30th, we would now be able to say the system is P25. There are P25 IDs that have been provided to every radio, regardless of whether it was on the network today or future. Now they would be able to utilize those radios.
So when I go back and tell my county commissioners, we're guaranteed by June 14.
Now, based on the budget that you provided us, we will be done by June 30th, 2014, because the money runs out.
And I've got a U.S. Open also.
Yes, sir.
So I
need June 12th.
Right.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Representative McNeil.
Yeah. Well, the longer we go on, the more questions I think about. But anyway.
That's fine. We're here.
How many private, well, not private systems, but I know several like Guilford and some others have their own infrastructure. Do those systems count in your 65,000 or not? If everybody in North Carolina, included the ones that you said want to be on it, all the police departments, all the counties, EMS, fire, and all that stuff, decided today that they wanted to be on it, would 125,000 be enough?
I'll give you a sort of a yes or no answer to that. Back in 2005, 2006 time frame, we went to every one of what I at that time would have called traditional public safety. And we said, how many people do you have on your rolls? You know, the Association of Fire Chiefs or the Sheriff's Association or North Carolina Police Chiefs Association. And at that time, 103,000 was the number. Now, that didn't take into consideration people like DOT. It also didn't take into consideration people who have kind of surfaced really since going back to 9/11 as non-traditional public safety. North Carolina Public Health, North Carolina Department of Agriculture, food services. You know, the quickest way to bring you to your knees is to mess up your health and your food. Man, those have become players, I think, in the national homeland security environment. So you got to add all those. Is $128,000 going to be enough? Probably not. And here's why I say it doesn't cause me great alarm. You mentioned locals. Yes, there are local governments out there with their own system. The largest would be Charlotte and their Urban Area Security Initiative system that covers two counties of South Carolina and nine counties of North Carolina. Do they have Viper IDs? Yes, they do. Do they have every radio that's on the Charlotte system having a Viper ID? No, they do not. So some percentage of them, I'll use Guilford, Representative Clark Bearcloth, Guilford County has their own radio system. Does every Guilford radio have a Viper ID? No. Some portion does. In some cases, they have to. All of the state's 184 ERs, emergency rooms, have a Viper radio. So that means that every ambulance in the state that's going to go to that emergency room has to have a Viper radio, regardless of whether the county has their own radio system or not. So in some cases, there are 20-plus local systems that use a very similar technology as to what Viper does, that they have a larger count, a larger number of users being served at the local level than Viper would have represented from their county. If you kind of look at it this way, Viper is the state's superhighway system or the state's, you know, interstate system. Not every car is going to leave the county and get on the interstate, but there are some that you need to have the ability to drive on the interstate. Those are the ones consuming those Viper IDs at the state level, even though their day-to-day use is on a local system. So whenever they come over and say, I bought a pass to ride on the toll road, I'm on the state system, they're in my count as well as at the local level. And I think that's where you would see the ability to serve with the 128,000 is that many of those cars are not going to come over onto the state system, and the locals, predominantly your largest municipalities, have their own system. So that count isn't inflating or taking away from the amount that Viper can serve on the state system.
All right. One other issue. I happen to live in Pinehurst, so I hear of a lot of conferences that go on in Pinehurst. I attended a meeting the other day and heard a presentation from FirstNet, and I think you can elaborate. But the speaker indicated that Viper would be outdated and we wouldn't need Viper in a couple years, that FirstNet would be the choice. I found that to be alarming, and so I came back and asked our staff, and they were kind of alarmed that we have another agency within our government saying that Viper is going to be outdated with FirstNet. And I would just like to get your comment, please.
I'll elaborate on that with some perhaps.
And a little history of FirstNet, maybe.
That's right. Going on now for the best part of 10 years, the federal government has tried to set aside a portion of what I would call real estate or frequency spectrum to build a nationwide broadband initiative. Broadband would be predominantly data, to be able to provide a platform for emergency responders to communicate and receive situational awareness, data, pictures, etc. Believe it or not, we're very accustomed to that here in that we all pretty much have a smartphone or access to a smartphone where you can get all kinds of great information. Yeah, we all use it for things that are not related to public safety, but public safety can get this kind of information via a smartphone. North Carolina has obviously a very good footprint from our public carriers, our Verizons, our Altels, our AT&Ts, Sprints, etc. But not all of the states in the country are like that. So there are many areas in this country you can go that you cannot get that kind of data information. So the federal government has been trying to make sure that there was a program in place to deliver that nationwide. That program has morphed and changed names a few times. It was the Public Safety Broadband Trust for many years, and now it has come to be known as FirstNet, which is part of the U.S. Department of Commerce, not Public Safety, Commerce. All right. Moving forward, the states themselves, the governors in the states, were asked if the states would like to participate in that. And obviously, they called it opt-in or opt-out. And in North Carolina's case, we said we want to opt in, and we want to at least look at what this service might provide to the citizens and public safety in North Carolina. So there is a group within the Department of Public Safety that has been tasked with looking at FirstNet. A portion of money was appropriated. The state had to match that funding, and a planning process is to begin. The key word there is planning. We are 3 years to do planning. That is the time frame that the U.S. Department of Commerce has said states need to spend exhausting those funds and deriving a plan for each state. Once that's done, all those plans will be rolled back up again, and we'll look at where we're headed with that. There is a gentleman by the name of George Bacolia that handles that program for North Carolina. Unfortunately, I think there's some misconceptions being portrayed about what FirstNet is and what FirstNet isn't. First and foremost, FirstNet is a data system. It is designed to provide broadband data. Now, we all know that we probably do more dataing than talking with these devices now. Texting, internet, email, pictures, Facebook, etc. I certainly know my children do more of that than they ever do talking on the telephone, because when I call them, they don't answer the phone, and the argument usually is I was reading email or something like that. So bottom line is this device is primarily a data device. Could the FirstNet system one day support voice, just like this device is also a voice device? The answer is probably yes. However, I think the key thing is we haven't even begun, we as states have not even begun the planning yet. So it's very premature to say that this is going to replace a technology that we have today. I'll interject this to say P25 is a federal standard. It is a standard for communication systems, and I would kind of use the federal government as a good litmus test, despite their shutdown right now, is what is the federal government implementing at its own installations nationally? It's implementing P25. So our base radio systems have been brought up to P25, just like VIPER is. So the hesitancy to say, is FirstNet going to replace VIPER? Maybe 1 year down the road, it will. But in the near future, 3 years before we even have a plan, and then that plan's going to be vetted against all the other 49 states to come up with what is a national plan. And the other thing I'll point out to you, just for reference, this device is about, in technical terms, this is a 100 milliwatt device. Now, you might remember in the presentation I gave earlier, we talked about a 3-watt device, which is what a VIPER portable radio transmits. 241 sites is going to provide 95% coverage with a 3-watt device. If you look at North Carolina's carriers, our public carriers, Verizon, who has probably the largest number of sites, it numbers 1,500. So this 100-milliwatt device, which is what a FirstNet data handheld device is going to look like, requires 1,500 sites to support it. Now, $189 million for VIPER? I leave it open-ended to what the price potentially will be to get to that first net goal. I think we confuse things a little bit. I won't go any beyond that to say why that's being said, but I think the facts don't support that statement.
Thank you. And I guess my concern is, you had mentioned, is the first net under DPS. I go out in the public and I hear DPS say this, I hear DPS say that, and we, a lot of $25 million, and I'm thinking, holy cow, did we just, this guy's saying that it's going to be obsolete. So, and I understand that a trooper or a law enforcement officer is not going to get injured out on the highway. He's not going to text that I need help. And where I'm at, he needs to be able to use his voice radio. And I'm behind that 100%, believe me. But I'm just concerned with the agency as far as conflicting stories and where do we need to spend our money.
I would say I'll take that under advisement.
Thank you, sir. Representative McNeil.
It's me again. I know the next, I guess, timeline for narrowbanding for the federal government is 2018. I believe that's right. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is that going to affect Viper any? That's one question. The second question is, I know when the 2013 narrowbanding took place, you saw probably an influx of agencies wanting to get on Viper. Do you anticipate an even larger influx of agencies when the 2018 deadline comes up?
I really don't, and you're correct. We saw a huge growth. In less than 18 months, we grew 24,000 users, and the majority of those 24,000 users came from local government saying, why would I pump money into narrowbanding my legacy technology versus joining an interoperability system like Viper? So I think we saw a huge growth of that to comply with the FCC's mandate in narrowbanding. The narrowbanding mandate did not apply to 700 and 800 megahertz spectrum. It was below basically 500 megahertz. Moving forward to 2018, by going to P25, we have set ourselves up to be able to deal with that mandate automatically. Pete, one of the requirements is to be able to do the narrow banding of the spectrum that Viper uses is P25 is the modulation for the format that supports that narrow banding. So I think we've set ourselves up to be able to accommodate that seamlessly when the time comes.
Any other questions? I have one more.
Yes, sir.
You mentioned that FirstNet is under DPS.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And this may be to our legislative DPS. Could we get a copy of the committee and how it's funded? Because I think that'd be interesting, because I don't remember us talking about it in the appropriations, or maybe we haven't, Christine. So, ma'am. Aunt Christine?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The FirstNet is being handled under the IT oversight, so that's why y'all haven't talked about it very much in JPS. Viper is voice, FirstNet is data, so FirstNet is IT, and Viper is with y'all.
But it's still under DPS.
Yes. And Brian can correct me if I'm wrong here. I believe that position is being funded through IT from a federal grant. So it is not a general fund appropriation that is paying for the FirstNet position.
Okay. I guess then my next question to Mr. Ryan would be, is it under the DPS flowchart? Okay. I think what we're finding out, I just run a simple business. You know, there's only 100 pennies in a dollar, but y'all, it's somebody else's responsibility. And so if we could just get that for this committee, I'd appreciate it. Any other questions? Oh, you all right? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Hodgson. And I'll tell Moore County we'll be expecting you real soon.
Yes, sir. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. At this time, we'd ask Richard Taylor, Executive Director of the NC-911 Board. The reason I brought this up is that I had I kept getting reports. I see on TV, 911 centers are out, dial this number, in different parts of the state. And the only media source I had was in the Triangle. So I called Mr. Sprayberry, the Director of Emergency Management, and there again, he said that wasn't his department. But he would look into it and get back with me. So, and he did, and he said that was the 911 board. And so I asked Ms. Leggett if we could just have a report of the outages that had happened throughout the state of North Carolina, and where did the 911 board fit in, since it's emergency and it didn't fit under the emergency management or DPS, and it's under IT again somewhere. So that's why we're here, just kind of clarify where everybody's at and see what we need to do in the future or if we need to do anything. Mr. Taylor, if you'd like to take it, we're glad to have you here today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great to be here and great to talk about one of my greatest passions, and that is 911. And from the invitation stated that you wanted to learn a little bit more about first the history of 911 and learn about our relationship with emergency management and also to learn a little bit about what the 911 board does. And then probably the biggest issue is to find out about the 911 outages and what the 911 board, along with emergency management, what we're trying to accomplish to resolve those issues, and as we move forward, what we'll do. So myself, along with Director Sprayberry, hopefully we'll try to answer those questions for you today. The 911 board originally started as the Wireless 911 Board back in 1998, and that was created basically under order of the FCC to require cellular companies to report the location and the telephone number of cell phones to the 911 centers across the state. Now, I will try not to talk in acronyms, and if I do, I apologize right now. We love our acronyms. You may see on the slides PSAP, which stands for Public Safety Answering Point. That is a 911 center. So if you see PSAP, that's what it is. And if I say PSAP, that's what it means. But I'll try not to use that terminology. I'll try to speak so that you understand. Back in 1998, the legislature of North Carolina, in compliance with FCC Order 94-102, created legislation which created the Wireless 911 Board, which would collect a single fee for 911 statewide, collect that fee, and distribute that fee across the state to our 911 centers to receive and utilize the 911 data from cell phones. We were not assigned to any state agency at that time. However, the chair of the committee or the 911 board, the wireless board at that time, would be the Secretary of Commerce or the designee. In 2008, 10 years later, the board was created to be the 911 board, which basically combined wireline, wireless, and VoIP, voice over IP, to be a single 911 fee. Meaning at that time, all the counties and cities across the state had different 911 fees, ranging anywhere from $0 to $3.50. And at that time, also, some counties were wanting to increase the fee to as much as $4. And it was getting a little bit out of hand. There was no oversight over the wireline fee. The fees were being used for all types of things, even though the legislation required only certain uses. There was no oversight, as there was with the wireless fee. And so it was decided that we would put everything under a single board with oversight with a single set fee statewide. And so the board was created. And then at that time, it was put under the Office of Information Technology Services with the state CIO or his designee or her designee to serve as the chair. And I will real briefly go through what the duties and the powers of the board were or were given to them at that time, because this is kind of important because there's a lot of different things that the board is charged to do. The first thing is to develop a state 911 plan for 911, and that is key because there never has been a plan for 911. With 100 counties, 127 911 centers, there has never been a relationship from county to county with 911. It's been everybody do what they wanted to do and no real relationship between each of our counties. Also, there's a lot of new technology being developed. We call it next generation 911. You hear a lot about texting the 911, doing video. We just heard about FirstNet and the ability to do texting and video and those types of things, a lot of data. 911 is very much a part of FirstNet in the future. And that is very key to what we're doing with our next generation technology. And so the 911 board has to look at that technology and plan for that. So we have to look at that technology and plan for it. Enhanced 911 services, GIS, the mapping technology, which Michael talked to in just a few moments, is very key to what we're doing. Also, we have to formulate strategies for efficient and effective 911 services. Believe it or not, because of the lack of planning, with 100 counties, 127 911 centers across the state, we do not have the same level of service across North Carolina. There are some counties in North Carolina that, honestly, if you dial 911, it would be almost a surprise of the level of service you get. It is embarrassing. And so that is part of our job, to get that level of service up so that wherever you go in North Carolina, at least there is a minimum level of service. And so that's part of what we're trying to do. Also, we administer that fund. We collect the funding, and we distribute it to all of our 911 centers to be sure that they have all of the proper equipment. We also distribute money, and there's another one of those acronyms, CMRS, that stands for Commercial Mobile Radio Service. That's another word for wireless company or cell phone company. They are reimbursed for their cost to provide 911 services. We have to establish policies and procedures as well as standards for our PSAPs. There are no standards right now for 911. None. Zero. Zilch. No standards. No requirements to be a telecommunicator to answer a 911 call. Unless you work under a sheriff, then there is a requirement. But if you work under emergency management, if you work under a police chief, if you work under a fire chief, no standard required, no certification, no training necessary. Now, many of our fire chiefs, police chiefs, do use the training offered by the Sheriff's Standards Commission, but there's no requirement to do so. So you can just hire somebody off the street and put them in there to answer a call. That's why that level of service is so important. That's why the standards. That's one of the hardest things that we're working on right now, because so many folks don't understand standards. They don't understand the implementation of standards. So we're working very hard on that, and that is one of the most difficult things that we're working on right now. Also, the use of the fund. It is a restricted use, and a lot of folks don't understand that. We do go in and we do look at how each of our PSAPs, our 911 centers, use that 911 fund. And we do find that a lot of folks misuse the fund, and we ask them to replay the fund because it is a restricted fund. Also, the board is allowed to go into contracts, enter into contracts for our obligations to help operate with, and also we are able to do statewide projects to help all of our 911 centers, and we're able to accept gifts or grants for 911 funding. The federal government has, from time to time, offered 911 grants through USDOT, and we're able to accept those grants if we apply for them. Also, we have to operate in a neutral manner. We cannot favor any type of technology, and so we have to be very neutral on everything that we do. This is something new that was added a couple of years ago, public education, and we are just now getting fired up about that. Especially for those that are in the 919 area code. They just started the new overlay, and we are experiencing a terrible problem with missed dials. It is very, very serious, and so we're trying to do a public education campaign right now in the 919 area code for missed dials, because it is a very huge problem. And then also with our standards, the standards will become rules, and we do have rulemaking authority, and we're in that process at the time. And then, of course, we can do other other actions that, as necessary to implement. In North Carolina, our 911 centers fall under several different authorities. 39 of our centers report directly to a city or county manager. 29 of our centers report directly to a sheriff. 27 report directly to emergency management. 25 report to a police chief. 3 report to emergency technology. And 4 report to someone else, like planning or a fire chief or some other individual, for a total of 127. When you look at it from a state perspective, and I've served the last 6 years as the national president of the National Association of State 911 Administrators, so it's a mixed bag. But just looking at the coast, the southeast, Florida, their 911 board falls under the Department of Management Services. In Georgia, they do not have a state agency. In South Carolina, their 911 board falls under the State Budget and Control Board. In Tennessee, it falls under the Department of Commerce and Insurance. In Virginia, their 911 board falls under the Virginia Information Technology Agency, much like North Carolina. And in Maryland, it falls under the Department of Public Safety and Corrections. So you can see there's no set standard how 911 boards are handled across the country. Now, how do we work with emergency management? Mike, here's your time.
Thank you, Mr. Taylor. And we were asked to talk about how we get along and interface with the 911 board, and it's just in a couple of ways, actually.
Mr. Sprayberry, can you introduce yourself? This is being recorded, please, in the title.
My name is Mike Sprayberry. I'm the director for the Division of North Carolina Emergency Management. And so how do we work together? We have in 2010, we had an ortho-imagery project so that we could provide accurate mapping to 911 so that when they're responding, they'll have accurate maps. Basically, we did all the acquisition, processing, and quality control, I think was a very successful project. And so the 911 board has accurate maps. Currently, our GTM section, Geospatial and Technology Management section, is under contract with the 911 board. And what they're doing is they're providing quality control for horizontal accuracy as they're making sure that the maps are kept up to date and very accurate. So that's basically the type of interface that we have with the 911 board. Now, after Mr. Chair gave me a call, as you referenced earlier, I reached out to Mr. Taylor, and we were talking about public safety answering point short outages. And so I asked him if we could get to the table and talk about what needed to be done whenever there are outages, and he graciously agreed to invite us to come over. We're now a member of that group, and I would tell you that I agree with him. I think that we need to have standards for 911 centers. That's very important. We're a big believer in standards over at emergency management. So basically that's the three things that we've done. We've had a contract with the 911 board back in 2010 to provide accurate mapping, ortho imagery, flyover. We did, like I said, acquisition, processing, and QC. We also are under contract with them now to provide quality control for horizontal accuracy for their mapping now. And we're currently on the PSAP outage work, or a focus group is what they call it. So that's where we stand right now, Mr. Chair. I'll turn it back over to Richard.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer.
And one of the things I would like to say about the orthography or ortho-imagery project is that project has been probably one of the best projects that we have ever accomplished. Not only with the teamwork that has gone on with emergency management, but also every county in the state has received those orthos free of charge. And I spoke just last week at the Association of North Carolina Property Mappers Association, and those folks were so appreciative of those orthos. And if you looked at the one slide earlier, that shows that when we first started that project back in 2010, some of the counties across the state had not even received up-to-date orthos in, his, I think, like 9 years. And now they know that every 4 years they will get up-to-date orthography at no cost. And that's huge. That is a huge cost savings for the counties. They're getting up-to-date orthography where they can do up-to-date parcels, their tax maps. It's just a huge bonus for them. In addition, for the 911 centers who are able to do up-to-date mapping, their up-to-date locations for AVL location for their public safety responders. So it's a huge project that benefits a lot of folks. And so that is one project that we can all be extremely proud of, and it just continues to go on. The 911 board has taken that on as a continuing project, and we're excited about it. We're excited that each of the counties across the state have been able to benefit in many, many ways. In 2006, the wireless board recognized the problem that many of our 911 centers did not have an adequate backup system. And so it was a problem then. And the board recognized it and encouraged centers to go out and create a backup plan. There was questions at that time about, well, is it something we can use our 911 funds for? And they wanted to make it clear that you could. And so we drafted a policy, and we sent this letter that you see, and there's more to that letter. But we drafted that policy, and we sent it to every 911 director in the state, as well as every city and county manager. Since that letter went out, November of 2006, we only have 23 out of that 127 911 centers who have an approved plan. 23 out of 127. That's kind of scary. Out of that 23, there's also 19 who have plans pending. We try our best, our staff, to go out and encourage our 911 directors to get a plan put together so that in the event something happens that their 911 center should go down, that those 911 calls go answered. 23 out of 127. We provide the funding for the equipment. 23 out of 127. Our standards, our proposed standards that we're working so hard on, requires each center to have a backup center. But our standards have not been approved yet. Our standards keep getting pushed back, and we have, you know, folks who don't understand the standards, and we understand that. And we've been working with different groups because they have, you know, reasons, and we understand the reasons that, you know, they want to, you know, for other reasons why they don't want the standards to be passed at this point. And we understand that, and we're working with them. But there are certain standards that we need to move forward on, we need to get passed. This is one of those reasons. This is one of those reasons. We have got to get our backup centers in place.
Mr. Taylor, if
yes,
I could
sir.
Interrupt one question.
Go right ahead.
What year were you given the authority to make rules?
I believe it was in 2012.
Who do you have to ask to get these standards passed that you said they don't want to get passed?
Well, they go through
when you have the ability to make rules.
We have to go through the rules-making process. We've had, I think it's either been at least once or twice, bills have been introduced in the legislature that had moved the dates out, delaying when the rules could be enforced.
Okay, thank you. So this body is holding that process up?
It has, yes, sir.
Is it holding it up now?
No, sir.
Okay. I'm like you, and I'm also concerned that 127, only 23 have done it, and I don't, and you feel like you don't have the authority to make that mandatory, which I find disturbing, since you give them the money. And you also told me you have the that you can do rulemaking.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No. I've asked that question many times. The board has asked that question many times. Our standards committee has asked that question many times.
And I would like to know who is holding it up. If it's this body, then I think we need to address it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Over here on the...
Yes, sir, Mr. Newton.
Senate's been kind of quiet, but this is intriguing conversation, and I, like you, I'm curious about the rulemaking and what's been holding up, and I don't wish to quibble at all with our distinguished speakers here, and I appreciate the information they're given. I'd like to ask staff if they can help us with that, because my understanding of rulemaking is that we would have to affirmatively block a rule, and I just don't have a memory of voting on anything that would block a rule. So, you know, if we are holding it up, I'd like to get to the bottom of it, too.
Thank you, Senator. Staff, please.
I believe he's referring to the rule about if a rule is passed, unless there are, I believe it's a number of objections to the rule, it does go into effect. And if there's no vote by the General Assembly not adopting it, then it does go into effect during the next session. Subsequent to that rule being adopted.
What, just for clarification, it never got that far in the rule process because a bill was introduced that said the rules would not take effect until 2015.
And do you know what bill that is, please?
I would have to go back and look.
Was that this session?
Well, there was one introduced this past session that said 2015, and that bill... or that piece of the bill was taken out, but there was language introduced in 2012 that moved it out to 2014, and then in 2013 it was moved out to 2015. I can get those bill numbers for you, but I don't have them with me
Senator
today.
Senator Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I could ask Hal again, Mr. Pell, is it the, and I'll frame the question this way, is it the introduction of a bill that would delay a rule, or I thought that we had to actually pass a bill that would, before that rule would be delayed.
It was. We'll wait on Mr. Pale, please.
We're going to check what the statute provides for that. There's a specific period of time in which, if no action is taken, then it becomes a rule. But we're also going to check the actual bill that was filed. If it did provide for a specific effective date, then that would be an overriding statute, which would basically delay the implementation of the rule until the date specified in the new law. So we'll check that.
Senator Newton.
But from a procedural standpoint, how would it have to be passed, or just the simple introduction of a bill could delay? I didn't think you could just delay it by introducing a bill.
Senator, I think there's two separate issues here.
If you could
Susan Seitz with the Research Division. There's two separate issues. One is that there is a process by which the legislature can block the implementation of a rule that has been adopted pursuant to the APA. What I believe, what Mr. Taylor is saying is that there was apparently a bill that specifically said any rules adopted pursuant to that process will not take effect until X date, which is a totally separate issue.
Right.
And I'm looking now to see if I can find that legislation.
I don't remember coming up, or maybe we did.
And that is correct. And I have those bill numbers, and I'll be glad to send those to you.
Oh, we're here today. We're going to find out.
Okay.
Unless we want to come back tomorrow. Got to work.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Ms. Sykes.
In 2012, it was Senate Bill 94. You enacted a law that said no operating standards set by the 911 board pursuant to Article 3 of Chapter 62A of the General Statute shall be effective until January 1, 2014.
Follow up, or you okay? Okay. So, yes, sir, I'm sorry.
Mr. Patrick, back here, Representative Chief of Police, we
Thank you. And if you would state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Fred Baggett. I'm the legislative counsel for the North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police. And we plead guilty to what you're trying to look into. We asked Representative Faircloth and others to introduce legislation in 2012 to delay the implementation of the proposed operating standards which the 911 board had promulgated. The police chiefs, of course, operate a lot of PSAPs. And we had some serious issues with some of those standards, but they appeared to be on the way to effectiveness in spite of some of the questions we had. Not to say that the 911 board and its staff weren't entirely listening to our concerns, but we had an effective date pending, I believe, of July 1, 2013, which created a great deal of anxiety and concern among some PSAP operators, meaning police chiefs and others, that they simply couldn't comply. So we sought this legislation, among other goals in legislation, which was later dropped. But one of the goals was to at least delay implementation of these rules until some of these concerns were addressed. I'm glad to say, number one, the rules were put off for a short period of time, but they are now underway with our active involvement. And a lot of the rules, proposed rules, Mr. Taylor can correct me, whether it's a lot or some, but certainly some of the rules were changed which did ameliorate some of our concerns. So we support standards. We support the 911 board having the power to adopt standards, and we're actively involved in the finalization and the effectiveness of the standards that are now proposed. So I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Any other? So if you'll just kind of zero in that in 14, these will become standards for all 127 centers?
That's what we're trying to accomplish now. As rules, they will probably not be complete with the rule process, simply because we just got back on track because there was a bill introduced this past session that was trying to push it out to 2015, and it did. That bill passed the House, but it did not make it through the Senate. And so, until it didn't make it through the Senate, we were not able to, you know, get back on track.
So hopefully, you're telling me you just didn't stop work until you found out what the bill was going to do.
Well, we were trying not to stop work, but we were more concerned about what that bill was doing.
Okay. And the police chief, is it Baggett, Mr. Baggett?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just clarify one thing for me here. In the handout, page 4, it says that there are 25 police chiefs that are control of 911 centers.
That's true as far as I know.
Okay, that's just a small percentage of all the 911 centers. I would just thank you. Any other questions before we move on? Now, one other question. The 911 operator, and it goes through this rule process, they will become EMDs, emergency medical dispatchers. Is that correct?
That is one of the things we'd like to do, but there is a little bit of a twist there. Office of OEMS has the authority for EMD, and so we're working with our legal counsel and their legal counsel to try and figure out who has the authority, because we do not have the certification authority for that.
And
so what is your 911 operator going to be certified to do?
In everything except EMD. But we want them to be certified with EMD, so we're trying to figure out who has that actual authority. We have the ability to train them to be an EMD, but right now we don't believe we have the authority to require them to be an EMD.
You have the money, don't you?
We have the money.
Well, that usually rules.
Well, that's exactly how we looked at it, but the actual authority, and that may require statutory change. We don't know, but that's why we're letting the two attorneys look at it.
Okay.
But that's what our goal is to require all of them to be EMD certified.
Before we move on, I'd just like to one comment. I mean,
sure.
It's kind of enlightening to know that we don't have a standard of 911 when we dial 911 throughout the state. That, to me, is a little disturbing. And since you've been in power since, 08, it's a little bit disturbing also. As a private person, that something needs to be done, you do it. With that said, I'm sure there'll be other comments. I think we're on page 8. And before we go to page 8, I'd like to ask the Sergeant of Arms to pass out some information that I had requested. What they're passing out is that it came to my light in Moore County that our outages went out a couple times. Two or three of them I know were our mistakes, because we were moving from a one 911 center to another 911 center, and I totally understand that. And a lot of it was electrical, a lot of it was in-house, but there was one incident where it was a 911 issue, and the software did not throw it into a backup system. So I called our staff and asked how many 911 outages were there, because I'd seen them on TV at Wake and Orange. And so I asked how many were there. And then Ms. Leggett asked, I told her I'd called Mike Sprayberry, Emergency Management, and he called Mr. Taylor. And that's where we're at today. And so I asked them if they would call the county County Commissioners Association, and that they would definitely have a direct line to all their county managers to find out what had happened, and that's where we're at today. And to the best of your knowledge, did you get a copy of the? And this is current?
No, that is not current. This is my list.
Okay. The last is 8-11, 8-12?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But this, I think, there's only 14 on here, and according to mine, this list is 2 weeks ago, there was 19. We're up to 19 now.
Okay.
And actually, as of this week, there's 20. We've had another outage.
You better stop talking now. So if you like to go ahead and proceed on, and a little history of where we're at now, okay, and my concern with 911.
All right. We did have another outage this week. I do not have the details behind it. It just occurred, I think, day before yesterday in Orange County. One of my staff members is gathering all the details. This list is one that we provide to the 911 board, which we give a little bit more detail on. But I just kind of summed it up since I just wanted to. First off, well, I was told I only had 20 minutes, so I was just kind of going briefly through this.
Well, you know, we're politicians.
Okay. But just in summary, 10 of these 19 outages are attributable to the telephone company, meaning that there was some type of failure within the CO in their central office, something failed. And when I say wireline, wireless being the cell phone company, or in the VoIP provider, Time Warner, Suddenlink, one of those companies, 10 of the outages occurred there. There was an accidental failure, meaning one of those was
I believe a truck hit a telephone pole, knocking the pole down, which broke the cable. I think we probably had one or two of Bubba and his mechanical fiber finder. Some people call it a backhoe. Hit a cable and broke the cable. Then we had five that were directly attributable to the 911 center, whether it was a lightning strike, power failure, or something of that nature. Roughly about 62 hours of total outages for 911. The part that is disturbing to me, when I look at this, regardless of whatever the failure is, you're always going to have some type of failure, no matter how good a system you build. The phone company, there's always going to be an accident. There's always going to be a bub in a backhoe. There's always going to be something that happens at a 911 center. What is concerning to me is that when it goes down, our planning needs to be in place that it comes back up somewhere else immediately. So no matter what happens, we don't have 62 hours of outages. That if it goes down in Moore County, that the calls are being answered either somewhere else in Moore County, or maybe they're being answered in Montgomery County or Wake County or somewhere else, so that no 911 call ever goes unanswered. That's the part that is troubling to me. You will always have outages. There's no way to become 100% preventable of that. Never. It will always happen. But what we can do is make sure that the calls will never go unanswered. That's the part that we can work on. That's the part that we can get the 99.999999% taken care of. With that, the 911 board, it just seemed like these were happening more frequent. We were not tracking them last year, the year before, but it just seemed like this year they were just happening all of a sudden, a lot. And the chair of the board said, let's start tracking these things because it seems like it's happening a lot. So we did, and that's why this list was created, because we wanted to know what's going on. Is there something that we can put our finger on? Is there something that's happening a lot? Can we say this is the reason why? And we couldn't really pinpoint it. About May or June, we said, we just don't know. But what we do know is that none of the backup plans are working. When you look at the centers on here, I don't think you'll find that you see a backup plan. One of the centers that went out, I asked him, I said, do you have a backup plan? He said, yeah, but it didn't work. I said, really? When did you create it? 1990. Really? Have you ever tried, practiced it? No. You've never practiced your plan since 1990? No. Whose fault is that? It's the phone company's fault. Really? Why is that? Because it didn't work. Have you ever practiced it? No. It's really easy to point the finger at somebody else. And that's part of the problem. We always want to blame somebody else when it should be working together as a team. So I asked the board, can we, get together and let's get our PSAP directors together and let's create a focus group and figure out what's going on. Let's look at why the increase in outages. Let's figure out why the lack of backup centers. Let's figure out, what are the possible solutions? And what can the 911 board, along with the state emergency management, what can we do to assist these 127 911 centers to figure out our problem? I know this is small for those who are trying to look at it, but your handouts, hopefully you can see it. I put out a message to all our 911 centers, ask for anybody to please come to Raleigh and let's sit down and let's talk about it. No requirement, just come. We had 22 out of 127 folks responded. And it was really kind of neat because we had a good mix of folks. I think out of that 22, we had four large 911 centers, Raleigh Wake, Gaston, Guilford Metro, and City of Durham. We had 11 medium-sized and 7 small. Had some folks from Currituck County, had some folks from Henderson, So we went all the way across the state. It was a good mix. And what was really nice about this group, they sat down, and they were very honest, very frank conversation, and spoke about why they didn't have 911 planning, backup planning in place. One of the things that they talked about, it wasn't a priority with them or with their county or city government. Most of them, for a backup plan, they needed a facility. 911 money does not pay for brick and mortar. It pays for technology. And they just don't have the money locally for brick and mortar, unless they get a 911 grant from the board, which would pay for brick and mortar. They just don't have the location to do that. So it's not a priority for them. It's hard to justify to their local government to come up with that kind of money. They also said there was a lack of testing because nobody ever thinks about it. Most 911 center directors wear a lot of hats. They don't have time to think about it. They're too worried about who's working 11 to 7 tonight. There's a lot of issues on their plates, and they never stop to think about it. We talked about a lot of different issues. They were very honest, very open. And I showed them different ideas. We talked about different things. I left them with some ideas that I thought would be a possible solution and gave them homework to study and asked them to give me their thoughts. And they responded back to me, and this was their answers. 38% said, we ought to have a hybrid backup PSAP. And let me explain to you what a hybrid backup PSAP is. It's kind of a combination of utilizing a 24-hour call center that already exists with certified telecommunicators who are certified in all three disciplines. When I say all three, that means law enforcement, fire, and EMD. It's already operating 24/7, and that as soon as a 911 center goes down for whatever reason, those calls are automatically switched to that center. The calls are automatically answered, and the calls are dispatched from that center to wherever in the state they need to go to. Now, they can operate for an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours if necessary. The hybrid part is that we also purchase a mobile command center, mobile-type command center. We have one stationed at the Western Data Center, which is in Rutherford County, and we have one at the Eastern Data Center here in Wake County. And if it's easier to have people go to the Western Data Center or the Eastern Data Center, we send them there. Or if it's easier to move that mobile command center to wherever that center is, we move the mobile command center to them so that they can operate out of there. Those mobile centers, regardless of what type of phone system, what type of computer-aided dispatch system, is already loaded with all of their equipment, all of their information. That way, they can operate without having to learn anything new. That would be our hybrid system. We could build a state ESI net. There goes the acronym. That's Emergency Services System. In today's vernacular, that's called our Next Generation 911 System. That's utilizing an IP-type network, which would connect our entire state together. That would be the greatest solution. Unfortunately, that's going to take a couple of years to build. But that would be the best solution. 18.5% said that each PSAP should build their own backup PSAP. That's not really a great idea because that means now 127 PSAPs, we would have 254 PSAPs, very expensive. Or 18.5 also said let's build a certain number of regional PSAPs to have. A couple of the comments, and I love this part, one said, it occurs to me there's no one-size-that-fits-all solution to providing backup PSAPs. Funding a backup PSAP for every primary or secondary, if they receive funding, is wasteful. Very true. So if we have everybody with their own personal backup center, that's a lot of money to spend and very wasteful. This one, I love it because this really spells out, and this is a comment from one of our responders. He said the 911 calls have to be immediately routed upon failure of the primary PSAP to another agency to be answered without any downtime. We have a lot of PSAPs that have a standalone backup,
but it will take them 10, 15, 30 minutes to get there. Who answers that call in that 30 minutes that they're going from their primary to their backup? Who answers the 911 call during that time? What if it's your call during that 30-minute time? Who answers? It needs to be answered immediately. The calls that are rerouted must be processed in a similar fashion that occurs on a daily basis at the primary. It has to be answered the same way. The caller needs to receive that same level of service that they do anytime. There doesn't need to be any interruption in service. It has to be just like it handles any day. And then the most important part, the calls must be dispatched the same way. And they have to be dispatched. What good is it to receive the call if you can't dispatch the call? So that's our three goals that we have to accomplish to have a good backup system in place. So what is our next step? The focus group made a recommendation to the 911 board to issue an RFP basically to accomplish those three steps. The 911 board said, that's a good idea, but maybe we need to take another look at it. Maybe we need to hire a consultant, and let's develop a business model to look at those three steps to develop that RFP. If we look at the solutions that we're possibly thinking about, some could be implemented within 90 to 120 days. We don't know cost estimates yet. Some could take 3 years. Again, we don't know cost estimates yet. The 911 board has made backup PSAPs a part of their proposed standards. Discussion now centers around requiring the annual failure simulations to include telco participation. Not just having the PSAP, the 911 center, do simulation, but make the telephone companies a part of that simulation as well. Let it be everyone participating in that simulation. Also, make a statutory change requiring full redundancy of all PSAPs in the most cost-effective manner, not just a standard requirement, but make it a statutory requirement. Again, when we talk about rulemaking and making a requirement in rules, what's the stick if they don't do it? We cut off their money, we punish them, then we're punishing all the citizens in that county too. So, you know, what's the right answer? What's the right answer? And then we want to look at maybe partnering with the state CIO as a consultant for us. There's a lot of pieces and parts here. This is a very complex issue. It's not something you can just say, there's the answer, and run out and do it. It's very complex.
Mr. Taylor, I hate to cut you off.
Go ahead.
I think you're on the last page.
I am on the last page.
At 2:55, we're going to take a five-minute break.
Okay.
Any questions from the panel here? Representative McNeil.
I just want to make sure I understand something. So beginning in 2014 now, these rules that you're making can be implemented. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. Is there anything else the legislature needs to do to assist you in that?
At this point, I don't want to say no, but I don't want to say yes. One of the board members and also the committee chair of the standards committee is here, and I'm looking at him. He's kind of shaking his head. I would ask him, David, would you like to
make it? If you need to identify for your short comment, please.
Turn the mic on, Dave. Push the button. There you go.
My name is Dave Korn. I'm vice chairman of the 911 board and chairman of the standards committee. One of the things we don't have as a board is any enforcement mechanism. We can remove funds from a PSAP if they decide not to adhere to the standards, but we have to give those funds all back. So it's not really anything that's of great value to us. You ask about legislation that could help. That would help.
Thank you. Representative Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking over your list of problems, and I know things happen everywhere, but the Winston-Salem PD was down for several days and apparently back in May, and we still don't have what the problem was.
That was one particular wireless carrier that was not able to connect.
and we're still trying to resolve the issue of why. They're able to connect, but they were not able to give us a reason why, but it was a just one wireless carrier not able to connect.
Are they connected today?
They are connected today.
Thank you. Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple quick questions. As part of the rulemaking process that's going to be implemented next year, is a mandate for a backup plan going to be part of those rules?
Yes, sir.
Follow-up?
Please.
If that's the case and that is part of the rules, and I think the other gentleman touched on this a little bit, what might be, I don't want to say repercussions, but lack of a better word, what are the repercussions if they're not able to afford it or not able to do it in that time frame?
There is provision in the rules, and it always has been in the rules, that if a 911 center is not able to meet the standards, they have the ability to come to the board and say, we're not able to do this. Can we get an extension? Can we get a delay? That has always been the case. And even though Mr. Baggett said they had problems, the Police Chiefs Association, we have told them many times, you know, if your agency, if you have a problem with any of the standards, we've always had a provision that says, you know, if you cannot do this, come to us and tell us. The 911 board has always ruled favorably with any 911 center when they've had a problem of not being able to perform any task.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Yes, sir. Follow-up.
Well, maybe two. One, yes, sir. Or is it cost, primarily, the cost to do this for the local governments?
Well, the cost would be probably in facility costs because the technology costs we provide for.
But
technology costs also, can salary costs be part of it?
Well, salaries are not an eligible.
Okay, thank you. All right, Dots.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question then. If cost is part of it, I know you all fund a lot of it too, but if cost is it astronomical to get this done? Is that, I just don't understand what the, as the outside looking in, what the pushback is from, is it the importance of it? Is it the cost? What are the rationale behind not having this done?
Again, what our feedback has been the facility cost has been the biggest piece of it, not having the facility to have an adequate backup center.
Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to what Mr. Baggett mentioned and perhaps clarify a little bit more the delay that was asked for in that bill. It was not only the police chiefs. It was also some sheriffs who were concerned. There were some county offices that were concerned. An example of a concern for a sheriff was, I think one of the standards you were looking at that time talked about two people manning a center, and the sheriffs that I talked with, a couple of them had situations where they might not have but two deputies on duty at night, and they couldn't put them both in that center, so they were concerned about that. Now, my compliments to all the group involved. They have moved forward. They're sitting down together, as I understand it, and I can tell you from the standpoint of developing standards for criminal justice in the state way back in the 70s, it's not easy. And when you plug technology into it as that real bear in the mix, it's not easy for these folks to accomplish that. And we need to do everything we can to help them get there. But everybody's got to sit at the table, and everybody's got to say their part. And when we roll it out, it's got to be something that'll work for everybody.
Thank you. Mr. Faircloth, are you on this committee, or have you had any input?
No, I had the bill that delayed it in the past.
Okay. I hope they notify you of some meetings, because you got some great insight into it. Representative Graham from Robinson County.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have more of a concern than I do a question. I'm looking at your the breakdown as far as personnel and the people that has this oversight for a valuable service. And you've got a lot of people here, the sheriff, the chief, the IT person, the county manager. You know, the county manager's, you know, a busy person, and I know he may have this under his umbrella, but my concern is if this is an emergency and a safety issue, why is it not more under the umbrella of emergency management? Is that going to be something you'll look at?
Is that a comment or a question?
No, I got a question.
Okay.
Is that something you'll be looking at in the future?
This is decided locally. We do not have any authority or even get involved. The decision of how it's done in each county is made by that particular county or city. We do not get involved in the local control of 911. Each county or city decides that, not us.
Thank you, Mr. Sprayberry.
Yes, sir.
How many emergency managements, first of all, I think we have 100 counties in the state.
Right, sir.
How many emergency management offices do we have?
We have 100.
On the local level.
On the local level, that work for the counties is 100, because Camden Pasquotank is, they run as one government, and then we count our eastern band of the Cherokee Indians. They're a partner of ours, and we treat them as a county, so there are 100.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any further questions? Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. Turn.
There was a discussion about the 24-hour service as being a backup plan. Is there such a place in operation now that is considered? Or
yes, ma'am, there is. And that was one of the ideas that we looked at just as a possibility. There is a location, a company that does provide that. They do have that already in operation. And, you know, it wouldn't be a guarantee, because it would have to go through an RFP process. But we did look at a particular company that's involved with 911 already, and they do operate a 24-hour operation with certified operators that could do this. And that's why I say we could probably turn them on within, you know, 90 to 120 days.
Follow up.
They would be able to participate right away then.
Yes.
And I forgot my train.
That's all right, Representative McNeil.
I know since some of these outages are, you know, only go on for 4 or 5 hours, but does the state of North Carolina not have a system that is portable? And that I think is maybe available through the Highway Patrol that they could come and set up for such emergencies?
Well, when you look at a system, we have 127 911 centers. And out of that 127, we probably have, and I'm just going to take a guess, I think there are 13 different computer-aided dispatch systems. And there's probably, I think, 12 to 14 different telephone systems. And so you would have to have the ability to have each of those telephone systems, each of those computer-aided dispatch systems, each of those mapping systems, all inside of that unit, which I don't think we have that in any of the Highway Patrol systems right now. We have seen such a unit that is available right now that specializes in doing that, and it would be available for us to use. We've actually used it in a couple of the centers in North Carolina right now when they've had to take a center down for, you know, they've had to do some remodeling. I think in Union County they used it for like 3 or 4 weeks. Richmond County is getting ready to use it as they do some remodeling over there. And it's a great system. They can just pull it up. They plug it in. It can operate completely independent. It has its own air, heat, everything. The telecommunicators, when they go in, they don't have to learn anything. It's just like they're walking into their own center. They're seeing their own telephone system, their own data, their own maps, everything. And that's what's so nice about it, is that there's no learning curve.
They walk right in and go right to work. And so when you're in an emergency situation, you don't need to be trying to figure out what's going on. It's just like an everyday situation to them.
Thank you. Mr. Taylor,
yes.
One last question and comment. I hope this will go through, and we do have standards. It's kind of disturbing that we don't. And is there any technology that we're missing or that is I know everything changes, but is there something that's missing in technology with these phone companies to update the software, or are we updated with all, I think you mentioned 14 different networks? Is there any software issues that we have that they need funding to make the system work better?
I would have to say no.
Okay. No. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
We have adequate funding.
I'm not talking about you.
I'm talking about our 911 centers.
Right.
We have adequate funding.
And the phone companies have the technology.
And they have the technology. The industry has the technology.
Right.
And we've got a staff person whose only goal is to make sure our 911 centers have the latest and greatest technology. And that's what her goal is to help them. So we're good in all those departments.
And just clear, how many are in your staff, your department?
I have two. Well, actually three. I have a financial analyst, and then I have two staff members that work.
So there's four total.
Including myself. Yes.
Right. Thank you. All right. We're going to take at 3:15, we will start with Commissioner Geis. We're in recess right now. David will be the last one, and we'll do the Sheriff's Association in November.
Appreciate the comments.
You can go ahead and we'll start with continue our program. I'd like to thank Mr. Taylor and Mr. Sprayberry for their report. At this time, we'd like to hear from Representative Commissioner Mr. Commissioner Reverend David Geis, a friend of the House and a friend of the Senate. And the godfather of justice reinvestment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And we love you, David.
I understand I only have 90 minutes, so I'll see if I can.
You got 120.
Move it along.
Mr. Chairman, he's already lost by half the members.
I noticed that. Maybe they'll come back in a second or two. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Angela, how are you today?
Good to see you. Thank you.
Senator Bryant, would you like to introduce yourself and the district that you represent? We're so glad you joined us this afternoon, and thank you.
Thank you. I don't want to hold up progress. I want to hear from Representative Commissioner Mr. Justice Reinvestment here. But I represent Nash, Halifax, Vance, Warren, and Wilson County. So,
thank you, and thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It is quite an opportunity, a humbling opportunity to be here with you today. And the topic that we're going to speak about today is the merger of the Juvenile Justice and Adult Correction Administration. And I want to first of all tell you that you have some information in your packet there. I didn't do a PowerPoint. I felt like that maybe we'd just hand you a document there. But there's two documents. One is some talking points, and the other is an O-chart, and that'll give you an idea of how we've got things set up. But first of all, let me say that the Secretary was here for a while this afternoon, and he had to go on and meet with the Governor, but he wanted you to know that he was here and he was listening to earlier conversations, and he has so noted some areas of concern that were mentioned, and he will be addressing those issues. But in addition to that, Secretary Perry has been working hard, and one of the first meetings that I had with him, he asked me to take a look at our organizational chart and take a look at adult corrections and juvenile justice, and to develop a plan where we might be able to continue the consolidation efforts that had been started a few years earlier with the integration, and the word integration is key here, with the integration of juvenile justice with adult corrections to create a new division of adult corrections and juvenile justice. And again, I emphasize the word integration. And in the talking point sheet that I have brought for your review, I specifically talk about things that I think are extremely important for those of us that are part of this process to understand. First of all, I would say to you that it was incumbent upon those of us that are in leadership at DPS to look closely at the commitments that were made during the budget process to become more efficient and effective in our operation. It was important when we indicated to you that we would find an additional $5 million in discretionary or in cuts that related to operational issues that we'd be able to do that. It was also important when we indicated that we would be able to find cuts in other areas that we'd be able to do that. So this process that I began was looking at our commitments that we had made to the legislature during the budget process, but also trying to find ways that we could ensure that we could be effective and efficient not only in the spending of taxpayer dollars, but ensuring that we continued to take care of public safety needs. Again, this consolidation effort began a few years back. This piece here is just an integration of juvenile justice to adult corrections. And what we have done is we have taken juvenile justice and basically lifted it up and placed it in the structure of adult corrections. We are not changing the mission of adult corrections, the Division of Prisons, the Division of Community Correction, or the Division of Juvenile Justice. We are not changing the mission. We are not putting children in adult prisons. We are not in any way changing programming. We understand clearly that programming for children and juveniles is entirely different than programming for adults. We understand clearly that we can't commingle not only the population, but commingle the offices in the community at the courthouse, because then again, you would be commingling the population. So we're not doing any of those things. In fact, we are relying on the same key people that have been working diligently every day in our communities with juvenile justice to provide us the information to help make decisions. They are our experts, and they continue to be our experts, and no changes have been made there. In talking with legislative staff here, and we met with them several times to have some discussion about this as we began looking at this. The thing that was emphasized to me over and over and over, there are things that are working and working well in the field, and you need to make sure that you keep those working in the field. So we have done just that. We do believe that we can find increased efficiencies in upper management and administrative support. We believe that, and I'll talk more about that shortly. We do believe that combining of resources will help support the field operations and services of juvenile justice. We believe that that what we're doing is streamlining upper-level functions while continuing to provide the same level of enhanced field services. Again, I'm going to repeat, the way we deliver services and supervise juveniles and offenders in the field will not change. There will be no mixing of juveniles and adults. Our field experts will continue doing what they do best, and the changes will only be felt in upper administrative level. With both juveniles and adults, now this is very important, and it's important as I presented across the state, which I traveled across the state and met with our staff, four different locations before we roll this out. In addition to meeting with management staff, I met with field staff, and I met also with folks that support juvenile justice advocate group that came to Raleigh, and I met and shared this presentation with them. We did all of these things prior to rolling this out. But this is a key. With both juveniles and adults, it's proven that a continuum of care is so important to a juvenile's and an offender's success and lessens the chance of reoffending. And I wanted to assure them, but also want to assure you, that we will continue to support that approach. The new division will be a team, and while we have differing missions, we want everyone to work together to help each other meet our goals, which ultimately is to make our communities safe. While upper management reporting relationships are changing, and I'm going to talk with you about that in the organizational chart, we will continue to reach out to each other to keep the connectivity and the cohesiveness of the entire team. We've all experienced change over the past year, but change can be good when we identify efficiencies and find better ways to work together and share new ideas. If you'll look at the color-coded document that I provided for you, you will see the organizational chart, and we normally don't do color-coded documents, but I wanted y'all to have this because this reflects actually how we're addressing each piece of the organization and how it's going to fit. For example, George Solomon is now the Director of Adult and Juvenile Facilities, and under George you'll see the blue.
And yes. And I think he's in the audience if you'd like to recognize him.
Yes. Mr. Solomon, if you'll rise for a second, let them see you. Thank you, George. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will as we go through this. You will see that under the blue there, you'll see where juvenile Dave Hardesty, our YDCs, the man, the gentleman that has been over our YDCs and our detention facilities, he remains there. His reporting line is directly to the deputy director of the adult and juvenile facilities. I think that's very important because we haven't stuck him within the organizational structure, so he's lost. He is reporting directly up to the highest levels of the division. And also, if you can see under community supervision, and Ms. Preseth is here, she is now responsible as Director of Community Supervision, which is juvenile justice and community corrections. You can see that Mike Reeder, who is the Juvenile Court Services, he is still in place. He is reporting all the way up to our deputy director who reports to Ms. Preseth. So, again, we didn't stick him reporting to someone in a region. He's reporting all the way up And that's extremely important because I want folks to know that we have that direct line. Juvenile justice has not been lost in this change. And then for programs, which is extremely important and a big piece for us. You can see Mr. Joe Prater is here. He's one of the deputy commissioners. Joe, if you'll rise. And also Mr. Tim Moose is deputy commissioner. Mr. Moose, of course, is over the section of Mr. Solomon and Ms. Presythe. And then Mr. Prater is over this big section here that you see. And the juvenile community programs, this individual has a direct report to Nicole Sullivan, who reports to Joe Prater, one of the deputy commissioners. In addition to that, just so you'll know, our Center for Safe Schools is also in that line. Nothing has changed there, except they now have a direct report to either a commissioner, deputy commissioner, or a deputy of community supervision or facilities. I would also like to point out to you in the far right, you'll see a column, and these are areas where we have shared in common operational, where we work together. In addition, we feel like these are areas where we can find some potential savings and can enhance field operations. Now, I'll just touch on a few. We all know that the educational piece is different in juvenile and adult. So we understand that. But we feel like that there's ways we can find efficiency there. Our food services, we purchase an awful lot of food within this huge operation that we manage, along with our health services. In fact, as I was making a presentation, one of the juvenile folks at one of the YDCs raised their hand and said, "Well, sir, let me point out to you that we're located here and we're about a few miles from a prison unit, and for the last year and a half, we've not had a psychologist at our facility. We really need a psychologist. Could that psychologist be used that's at the adult facility over here?" Possibly. That's just another example of a way that we can find efficiencies and we can help each other. Health services. We've got our own hospital. We buy a lot of pharmaceuticals. There's a lot of things that we can do that will enhance operations by us being able to manage it at this level. One would ask, why do you move in a direction like this in the middle of a year? I want to tell you that since I became commissioner, I felt a strong responsibility to make good decisions each day. And when I found ways that I feel that we could be efficient and effective in our operation, I feel it's my responsibility to do just that and move forward and move ahead. But it's important that I communicate with legislative staff, share information with the committee. But it's a decision that I felt like that, honestly, you guys would probably be coming to me in a short period of time when you came back in and saying, "Have you looked at this, this, and this?" It's just something that I feel compelled to do when I think that the operationally we can do some good work. So I will tell you that I feel like that as I've traveled around the state and I've met with the advocate groups and talked to judges and others, I feel like that we've gotten very little pushback on this issue. Those that have pushed back or that have written something in the newspaper, I would say to them, please come sit down and talk with us, because when I read something in the newspaper that says, "Hey, you're putting juveniles in adult facilities," or you don't understand programming, or you're going to change this, that, or the other, that's not the case. That's not the case. Quite simply, what we have found is that because adult corrections is very large, we have engineers in place. We have folks that over maintenance. We're able to work in those facilities and make those facilities better. Because we're so large, we're able to address a lot of issues and concerns that have been out there for some time in the juvenile world just because of our ability to do just that, and that's get things done because we have people on board that can do that type of analysis and help us. So I would share with you that I think this has been received in a positive way.
and we're going to continue to move forward. Would be glad to answer any question about this issue, and I know that we've got some other issues, but I want to give them an opportunity to ask questions.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Geis. Any questions on behalf of the committee? Yes, sir, Senator Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner Geis. Can you? I may have missed it, but what does the color coding? Is there something that means on here?
Yes, sir. The color coding just represents simply those areas. There are three areas in juvenile justice that we're fitting into the structure. The first area is facilities. So the color coding there with the adult being the blue, and down below you see the juvenile. It shows you how that actually fits in, and that's the YDCs. We have four YDCs in the state. I believe that we have six detention centers that, and two or three that are privately owned. But that's where that fits in. And then for community supervision, the piece is, of course, our court counselors, and the community supervision piece for juvenile is in the brown there and falls under community supervision. And then for programs, and there's a lot of program folks. In fact, we have a lot of great programs within our juvenile system, some 500 and something. And I've got to say to you that I don't look at that number as large. I look at that number as actually programs that are effectively working to help deliver services for our juveniles. So the programming piece falls under and falls up through Nicole, and that's why it's color-coded the way it is.
Senator Daniel, follow-up? Or
just a brief one, Mr.
Chairman. Sure.
Okay, so Commissioner Geis, I guess my understanding is this was done as an efficiency measure to try to bring two departments together and save money. And so were positions eliminated in order to do this, or are there new position titles that have been created? Can you give us some information about that?
Yes, sir, I can. In the work that we did at this time, there were no positions eliminated. However, legislatively, in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of positions that have been eliminated in the management structure of juvenile justice. And in talking with the staff here, the legislative staff, they emphasized to me that you would not find those kind of savings as it relates to specific cuts, position cuts, because those had already been taken. And this has been something that has been a challenge for the juvenile justice folks in the last year or so, trying to understand how they were to move forward with the a number of cuts that they had received. And this is another emphasis, I think, when you look at the overall picture of bringing departments together as we did back in a few years back. The goal was to be able to not do everything all at once, but as we made and identified the needs, then we could make additional changes. So what we have done here, we have not cut any positions. That's the amazing thing. But if you look closely back at what has been done the last couple of years, you will see a large number of positions. Even when I sat there as on the committee, a lot of positions were cut related to juvenile justice. But I will say to you that you still find these efficiencies in operations and being able to manage the overall organization better. And if you were asking me in the future, do I feel like that we'll find efficiencies, the answer is yes. And in some of those areas are those areas that I pointed out as it relates to our programs, as it relates to our food services, as it relates to our health care, medicines, and things of that nature.
Thank you. You okay, Senator? Okay, thank you. Senator Bryant?
Mr. Chair, I have a series of questions.
Sure.
And maybe a couple of comments. And Commissioner Geis, Thank you so much for taking on this humongous task.
Yes, ma'am.
One of the concerns I've heard, and maybe it's something that can be rendered. So my first question, the deputy correctors with directors on, in the central division, the blue and the orange with no names, are they vacancies or positions you're going to be filling in some manner? Or is that, am I misreading that on that line at, where you have deputy director and in yellow, assistant director of support services? Those places with no names, are they
no,
jobs?
All those positions are filled. We just didn't put the names in there.
Okay. Thank you. One of the concerns I've heard is that above the line in the central division, there is really no one with experience or expertise in juvenile justice, et cetera, in that kind of power strip. There of middle, I guess we'd call them maybe middle managers, you know, where the heavy lifting is going to be done in terms of the line management and perhaps, you know, policy input and implementation. Would you say that was a fair statement, or what's your thought about that?
Well, I would not say it's a fair statement in that, of course, what I forgot to mention, the executive officer, Mr. J.R. Gorm, is the former Commissioner of Juvenile Justice, so he is the executive officer. And while his responsibilities are not just for juvenile justice, because quite honestly, this is a huge operation that I've been asked to manage, and I need to have him flexible to assist me in a wide range of areas. Juvenile justice is one, but in other tasks too. He was just made the executive officer. In addition to that, I would say that if you look closely, again, no position's been eliminated. So what juvenile justice, what they had the day before the decision was made to move in this direction is exactly what's on this sheet of paper. They had Mr. Gorm, then they had Mike Reeder over community, and then they had Dave Hardesty over facilities, and then they had, at that time, was Robin Jenkins over programs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all they had. So we have kept everything that they had. Now, Mr. Jenkins is no longer with us, but that wasn't a decision of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But we're in the process of filling that position. But everything else is as it was the day before.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up. I think the concern is, and you mentioned it, that part of their strategy is this continuum of care. They were, those were the only people they had, they operated as a team in a small unit where Mike Reeder had ready access to the head of the person that was supposed to, you know, be the head of that unit, even though that person had to figure out how to get, you know, to the secretary or the commissioner, whoever was between them. So I'm wondering if you would hope you might give some thought to now they are more separated in these different units, which was not the way they function for this continuum. So maybe perhaps there might be a way they can have a juvenile task force, you know, something, some structure that would meet bi-monthly or something where all the key players get to come together and then somehow get to you the sort of expertise, policy, and the forward-thinking stuff you need on a policy and sort of administrative basis for as a group that you'll now only get if it kind of fizzles up to you, you know, through something that either one of these individuals might do. They don't really have a way to have impact as a group. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does. Yeah. Let me say to you that Mr. Reeder's office location and the people that he worked with before are still there. And Mr. Hardesty's where he worked before, and the same office for programs, and that staff are all still in place. Nobody's been moved, and I don't anticipate anybody being moved that I know of right now. So they have the same support that they've been having. I know what you're talking about coming together. I actually met with folks this morning from all three of these areas in a meeting, and we're having those type of meetings. But I meet regularly with my community staff. I've gotten everybody out of silos. So no longer does prison sit over and do their thing, and no longer does community correction, et cetera. We meet weekly. All these key folks meet with me weekly, and we work together to tackle issues. So there will be representation at the table weekly in these discussions about juvenile justice, et cetera. So if folks will just give us an opportunity to work this together, I think they will understand what we're doing. But my concept has always been to get folks out of silos, because we've got to become more effective and efficient with the resources that we have. Now, does that mean we're going to co-mingle what we do out here? It does not. Everybody has a special mission, and we're very unique in that we've got a lot of different missions and a lot of different balls that we have to balance. That's exactly why I have two deputy commissioners, one working overseeing an area and another overseeing another area. It's important that we have that balance. But again, of the 26 to 27,000 DPS employees, 24,000 approximately fall under this new division. So we are large, but we have tried to put in place measures to be able to get that kind of support and listen.
And one last follow-up. Sure. I think it will be, I'm hoping that we, even though things are changing, but we have some, and we have some things that's working, I hope that we figure out a way to support keeping as much of, or highlighting, capitalizing, I think is my word, on the institution, wherever that institutional knowledge is historically on juvenile justice, which now is going to be, quote unquote, at your lower level. So I think we want to make sure that we capitalize on it while we have it, and, you know, if people move on or whatever, we just don't have it. One of the fears is it'll just ultimately be so dispersed or diluted that we'll lose a sense of what we've had before, even though we know we have to make these changes, which I think are important. So, and I don't know the whole answer, but as you're looking at your picture, if you would keep that in mind, I think that would be important. Thank you.
I will.
And I'd like to comment also. I think the commissioner understands very much juvenile. If we can take care of them while they're there, we won't see them. That's exactly right. Exactly. We don't want to raise them. Representative Turner from Iredell.
Thank you. I wonder where I might be able to find an organizational chart that was prior to this so we can directly compare.
I believe we can provide that for you, yes. In fact, I believe your staff probably has that, but we can provide that.
Staff said they would. Representative Stevens, Surrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Geis, thank you for all the hard work you've done in getting this thing combined. But I know growing pains and changing pains are a very real process. With whom do we as legislators communicate when we have concerns? I don't see anybody here as the legislative liaison.
Well, the legislative liaison for the department has recently changed, and I think there'll be an announcement here shortly with regard to the legislative person. And I have talked some with the deputy secretary about that, and we are so large, I think possibly there'll be a couple of folks, maybe one assigned to law enforcement piece of the department, and one or two assigned to adult corrections because it is so large. But we will have that person. Ryan is working in that capacity now, I believe, along with Jarrett. So they will continue to work in that capacity until a decision's made. And, of course, most of you know I've got to know how to get in touch with me, and some of you do. So and it's good.
Follow up.
Sure, please.
Make sure we have last names, so Ryan and Jarrett.
Yes, I'm sorry. We'll get that to you. It's Jarrett Burr, and Ryan's last name?
Combs. Thank you.
He's not in here right now, I don't think, or he would have my head.
Representative Dobson from McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner Geis, for being here. And I'd also just echo what's already been said about the work that you've done and your staff has done to put something like this together. We do appreciate it. Appreciate you being here today.
Would it be fair to say that cost and streamlined efficiencies would be the top two reasons for this?
I think I would say probably efficiencies and cost, I guess. I look at cost a lot of different ways because I think that if you don't do some things that you need to do, you're going to pay later. And what I mean by that is we have the expertise with our engineering section and our maintenance section, and we've already started that over the last year or so to really help with updating the juvenile facilities. But in addition to that, one of the desires, I think, among elected officials is to get a good handle on why something operates a certain way. And if there are ways that we can improve things, and I believe that we have the experts within our field of work that can help us get to where we need to be as it relates to both adult corrections and juvenile justice, I'm very mindful of the national requirements and national concerns about juvenile justice, staffing patterns, and those types of things. We're reading and learning, and we're excited about the opportunities in front of us. But I think in the long run, yes, I think we will be able to see those costs and efficiencies in how we do good work. There is a real recognition that juvenile justice for years has done some great work as it relates to getting folks, young children, out of the YDCs and back in the community. They've done an exceptional job. Today we have probably 240 children in the YDCs, and years ago there was over 1,000 so or more. So exceptional work. That they've done has been based on evidence-based practices, very similar to what we have done with juvenile with justice reinvestment. So what we're finding is, as we're digging in, a lot of the things that they're doing as it relates to an assessment process and understanding risk and needs are the same things that we're doing in the adult world. It's just a little bit different for a different population. They work closely with families. We in the adult world deal more with just the individual. So there's a recognition on our part that there's similarities, but there's also differences. And again, I think we can find those efficiencies.
One follow-up. Thank you for that answer, and I appreciate that. That definitely helps on that. With regard to cost, you mentioned maintenance and engineering as two maybe areas of, I don't want to say savings, but things that we can look at to improve over time. And I think that's good as well. So I don't think it's really a question, more of a comment. So thank you for that, and I think that's a good thing. So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Charles Graham from Robinson, and then I have Representative Daughtry, and I have Senator Bryant.
Representative Graham. Let me correct you. It's Representative.
What else? Senator. Oh, I wouldn't put that on you.
Thank you. I don't know about all this. Let me thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Geis, thank you for your work and your obvious passion for what you do and working with our clientele in these programs. I just wanted to ask a question. When I look at the juvenile justice person here, Mr. Dave, I can't.
Hardesty.
I'm looking at the umbrella now. Would he be looked? And I come from an educational background, so I'm gonna kind of look at and say, would he be considered as like the superintendent? When we look at the big umbrella, is he responsible for all juvenile justice services, educational, quality of care, and those kinds of things?
He is responsible for the operation of the YDCs, Youth Development Centers, mm-hmm. and Juvenile Justice, and all those things that go on within those facilities. So, yes, he would be overall and responsible for that. He's just like in the adult world. He would be fall in the category of what one of our regional administrators, or in the community world, one of our judicial district managers. He is managing a section. Well, his section just happens to be involve four youth development centers and a total of 9 juvenile detention facilities, and in all of the things that go on in those facilities. He is at a very high level within our organization. While you might find that he's here, he in reality falls right here with these other regional folks that report directly to the deputy director of adult facilities. So he, in my opinion, he is very high up. We did not stick him in a region. There's a lot of ways this could be done. You could take each of those facilities and stick them under, say, an adult facility regional manager. But we did not choose to do that because I wanted them to have direct line to the deputy of the Department of Facilities.
So follow up. So he does have a direct line to a deputy within the overall?
He does.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. David, as you know, I live in a county where there is a prison, relatively large prison, and I hang around the courthouse a lot. And one of the complaints I get in respect to corrections is they don't seem to have any vehicles. Would you explain to me why they have not able to get around? I mean, they don't have bicycles. They've got to figure out a way to get these people able to move from one place to another.
And before we go any further, I think there's another issue also, is that you're talking about in transporting prisoners, but also in the vehicle. I also would like for him to address that we allotted money for the probation officers, and they don't have vehicles.
But I'm talking.
Not transporting prisoners.
No, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the question. Currently, we have approximately 1,700 community correction officers that are assigned caseloads. These are case-carrying officers that are sworn officers that are certified, that have a safety package, that carry a firearm, that knock on doors, that are in and out of offenders' homes. In the year 2012-2013, I believe that, if I can find my note here, fiscal year 2012-2013, the Division of Adult Correction paid to the Department of Administration $10.9 million, of which $7.1 million was for DCC, and that's community correction, for fiscal year 12-13 for vehicles, and that's the lease vehicles. We received that year 376 vehicles. 376 vehicles. 351 were new, and 61 were used vehicles. Now, again, I have 1,700 officers. Of the 1,700 case-carrying officers, I have 295 officers that do not have a vehicle assigned to them. So that means they're case-carrying officers with responsibilities to see people, but they have no vehicle assigned to them. This legislative year, when the legislation was passed, we were to get 175 new officer positions. 75 were to come on this first year. Budgeted for those 75 in the figures that are in the budget was for a new vehicle for those staff. As of today, I not only have 295 officers that do not have a vehicle. I have 75 new positions that are coming online that I have been given no indication that there's a vehicle for them. So that's about 360 vehicles that I'm short for case-carrying officers. So it is an issue, one that we are trying to work out, one that we very well might need some help on. It does concern me greatly because, as you know, I came from the field, and you can't do field work unless you have a vehicle. Some might say, well, can you just put vehicles in a pool? These vehicles, our staff are on call. These vehicles, they have to be ready to respond to situations, and they carry a safety package. You can't just lift the safety package out, which is all of your safety equipment, whether it be pepper spray or a flashlight or gun or whatever it might be.
Let me do a follow-up on, if you don't mind. I don't want to interrupt you, but if the 300 sworn officers you have now for the purpose of having a caseload of seeing offenders, and they're not worth 5 cents, are they? They can't get around.
Well, we're just having to borrow vehicles from person to person, and basically, I'm saying you're carrying your safety package in a bag or in the trunk, so you're having to lift it out and take it into the office with you while somebody else is using your vehicle. So we're tying folks up that could be out in the community seeing people. And I would say to you that the large majority of the vehicles that we have, and it's probably somewhere in the a neighborhood of probably 40% of the vehicles that we have in the field have over 120,000 miles on them. So this is something that is a great concern and seems to be worsening, and we got no, haven't had any new vehicles in quite a while.
Commissioner Geis, the $7 million, how many cars would that buy?
Well, I don't know. Y'all can do the math. Y'all know about how much new.
I mean, would that buy your 200, 300 cars? Or?
Well, the issue clearly is we lease these vehicles, and we're in a category. If you look closely, you'll find that we're in a category as says our staff drive a passenger vehicle. I would challenge the way that's written because our staff make arrests in those vehicles and have to transport
any cage
in vehicles, et cetera. They're not solely passenger vehicles, but we lease vehicles from the Department of Administration. My only concern is if every year I'm having to write, not me personally, but if we're having to write a check or send monies to the Department of Administration and we're not getting enough vehicles that we need, then we've got difficulties. So
can they account for the $7 million you've already given them back to you?
Well, I don't know if they can or not. That's something you'd have to ask them.
What I'd like to do is put this on next month oversight committee also, if that's agreeable with the committee here, that we need to look into it. If we've paid them, why we haven't received our goods. There again, that's one agency, and another agency is 911 and emergency management. And okay, Representative Daltrich. Thank you. Senator
Mr. Chair.
Brunt? Yes.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chairman.
Representative Geis, I'm still calling you by your old name, David. I was speaking with some probation officers the other day down my way, and one of their a concern that was noted to me, and I'm just trying to, again, figure out ways to help you guys as far as mission, maybe sometimes mission stretch. Under justice reinvestment, we have the 9 months of oversight when people are released. Our probation officers are now having, or are we having to literally go and pick up prisoners when they're released?
Yes.
Is that a good idea?
Well,
Because I just want everybody to understand before you go any further. We literally have probation officers. When a prisoner gets released, used to, they might get a bus ticket. They might just get on the phone and get mama to come get them. Now, we have to have North Carolina probation officers go pick up every released prisoner for post-release supervision intake, I guess. And I've had probation officers tell me, we get somebody who's going to be assigned to Wilmington, they drive to Charlotte, they drive to Highlands, they drive to Murphy to pick them up, and bring them back to Wilmington, importing the criminal back, the releasee, I guess, the former inmate, the former defendant, hopefully not, Moby's been reformed, all the way back to Wilmington, and our probation officers get to drive and pick them up and bring them back for free. Now, that's some vehicle usage there that I wonder what your thoughts are, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you very much, and I think it's a valid question. And let me clarify by saying that over the years we've had various policies relating to release of folks from prison. And what we have available to us today is very similar to what we had available years ago when we supervised a number of folks prior to 1994. In structured sentencing, and that is that we do make arrangements to have folks transferred to a local unit closer to home. That's done on a regular basis, and because we have the largest bus system in the state of North Carolina, we're able to transport those folks on a regular prison bus to a unit closer. That's happening every day. Very rarely do we have an officer anymore that will actually drive those long distances, because if we have one on short notice, someone in Asheville will drive and meet the person from the eastern part of the state at a certain location if we have to do that. But most of the time we make arrangements to put them on a prison bus and get them a little bit closer. So that is a little different. But in addition to that, we have a policy that we're working on. It's a policy that was in a place years ago, and that's direct release policy. And we're looking at that now. I don't think it's been implemented as of yet, but we're looking at that now, and that clearly is simply when someone, depending on, we wouldn't do this with our sex offenders, and we wouldn't do it with the worst of the worst, but we might do it with someone that is coming out and has just 9 months of supervision, and it's not that bad of a case. That is basically where we allow a family member to come and pick them up, and then they report at a certain time, a set time, back to the office. That worked well for years. And there's also opportunity for us to put them on a regular bus. For example, sometimes we can't get family to come from the western part of the state, and there's no bus system that runs in the western part of the state, but they run to Asheville. So we're able to put them on a bus, and we buy a ticket for them to go to that area. But most of the time, most of the releases, we are actually coordinating and putting them on one of our prison buses and bringing them closer home. That's how it should be working. So if it's not, we need to check on that. But that's how it should be working now.
I have Senator Bryant, Representative Mobley, McNeil, Faircloth, and Hurley.
Oh, my Lord.
I just wanted to one more question, Commissioner Geist. This was on a separate subject. I didn't want to mix it up with my other subject.
Yes, ma'am.
You know that one of the issues that's close to my heart is reentry. And we worked together a lot on that when you were here, and I'm appreciating your continuing to keep a focus on reentry services. And my judgment would be we might be a little further. While we have been doing a good job with reducing the juvenile population in the centers, I don't know that we've been paying as much attention to juvenile reentry coming out of facilities as we have with adults, or maybe they both need to be looked at. But I want to ask you, are we going to be able to continue and maybe even build increased support for the reentry councils and the coordinated services for reentry in some fashion? And has anybody been looking at how that correlates with what juveniles need who are, I guess, more serious offenders coming out of facilities?
Thank you. It's a very good question. And, yes, even today, we are building on the reentry program and building those groups of folks that are working in their home areas in communities all over the state. We are building those reentry councils because they are essentially critical in the success of an offender's return back to the community. We have Nicole Sullivan that is working on that, has her staff working on that. As it relates to the juvenile piece, that is an important piece. And we are just now learning and getting our hands on some of around some of the intricacies that we need as it relates to the juvenile system. Again, I think that there's an entirely different situation going on here. And the great thing about it is we at the top realize that. If I was standing here telling you we could commingle these things, I'd really, if I was sitting in your chair, I'd be scratching my head. But I'm not telling you that. We know that we can't, but we do still feel that having some of these key people have worked for years, even with the adult section, now reading and learning about the juvenile piece and then listening to our staff, those key people are going to be important. Billy Laster is one on the juvenile side that is so important, and he actually is working in the interim position that Robin was in, and the advocates think that's a great move, so we feel good about that.
Do you feel like you have the resources you need there, and do you have a sense of what hope there might be for getting more, if you need more? What's your sense of the resources you think you need to make that work?
The sense I have at this point is we're doing pretty well, but we're looking every day for opportunities to check about grant money and just the Vera project. The success we've had there and getting that $1 million grant is tremendous. We wrote our grant there, got that. It's going to help tremendously with education as it relates to folks coming out of the system, prison system, while they're there and now. The monies we got for the implementation of justice reinvestment, that $500,000 we have spent now, most of that's been on training. We have built, the good thing about it is we've actually implemented that training into our regular training that we're going to do on an annual basis now. So it's a real plus there. But I have great faith in you guys, and I truly mean that. If we have a need, I'll have an opportunity to come speak with you, and if I can explain it well enough, I feel like that we'll get the support and help that we need. So we're just trying to look closely at how we do business and see if there's some things that maybe we could do a little bit different that would enhance things. And at times it takes us kind of scratching our head and backing up. We don't say no to things now. We listen, and when someone in the field has a recommendation, we try to listen to them and understand it.
Thank you. Representative Mobley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Commissioner Geis, I'm amazed to see that your hair is still dark.
It's turning gray, but most of that gray is from living with my wife.
I heard about the merger. I've talked to some of the officers in the field, mostly from the juvenile, because that's where I had my stay. I know that you're going to have lots and lots of things that you're going to be addressing and working on, and I commend you for taking on the new challenge and the fact that you're going to become a grandfather with these children. But I certainly hope that as you work on with your staff realignment and whatever is going on, that you will think, and I know you will, I have confidence that you will, look at all of the aspects of what the requirements are for that address the needs of our young people for the state of North Carolina. And I'm not going to do much of asking questions of you today. I'll save mine until the next meeting. But I'm confident that with the work that I have, the time that you were in the legislature with us and the conversation that I've had with you, that you are open to doing the right thing for the staff and for the people that you have inherited. I've been asked some questions that certainly I cannot answer from some of the people out in the field. I know that your officers, adult officers, carry a firearm, and I've always had a permit for a firearm, but I've never had one. And I know that that's a very sensitive area for our juvenile people. In fact, that sometimes it's good they did not carry firearms And I hope that it's not one of those areas that you'll be looking at, because sometimes when you have firearm, you might have people who tend to use it when they shouldn't. But again, I commend you for the work that you have done with this merger, and I'll be back in November with some questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. And let me say that in listening to the folks in the field that are doing the work in juvenile justice, I was a couple things that I was struck by that were very similar to the folks in the adult correction field. One is a study was done sometime back as it relates to the court counselor pay, and that matter had not been addressed and had not been successful with. That is very similar to the adult correction folks, and of course in this last legislative session we were able to address some of those concerns relating to the adult correction field. And I'm working on a plan to address that issue with the court counselors. There were funds that were set aside, discretionary funds of $7.5 million, to address some of those inequities, and I have DPS, the secretary, has decided to put forth that at the top of his list, addressing for DPS the concern about that juvenile court counselor pay. So I feel good about that. We've still got to work it, but I feel good. In addition to that, they've been working for years on being able to use something like the technology that we rolled out to all of our staff as it relates to the smartphone, the ability to be able to address issues with your smartphone, whether it's take pictures in the field, whether it's address, find out case information, find out if there's warrants pending on someone before you knock on a door, all of those safety kind of things. The smartphone for the adult correction side is part of their safety package now. I believe it's something that is doable, and we're working on defining exactly what's needed in the juvenile field, and I believe we're going to be able to roll that out fairly quickly to them also. It's them being part of a bigger organization that has deeper pockets to be able to address those types of things. In addition, I would say to you that the safety package is a concern for me, because the juvenile officers, and I won't define the safety package for them because I don't know what it should look like, but they have no safety package now. They don't have a flashlight. They don't have a phone unless they've got their personal phone. They've got a few phones you can check out. They don't have a Viper radio. They have no communication. And I can tell you story after story where they go to the same door that the adult correction folks are dealing with, and they're dealing with family, and sometimes family, extended family, has all kind of issues and problems. So I want us to have that conversation, because safety of our staff is one of my most important concerns. And I've just seen too many situations and been too many places the last couple of years since I came back where staff have I've had to deal with issues where staff have lost their life. And I've been at national meetings where staff nationally have lost their lives in the line of duty. And when I'm at a meeting and I'm listening to a mother describe the loss of her son, who is the same age as my son, I will tell you, I listen, and I listen closely. And that was a community correction officer knocking on a door to check on a situation. And it happens quickly. So I have great concern about the well-being of our staff. So they will have a safety package in the future. They might not have a firearm as part of it, but they will have some type of safety package, whether it's a vest, whether it's what it is. And you got to remember, vests are different. In prisons, they need a vest that will protect you from being slashed or cut. But in the community, you need an entirely different vest.
Thank you. Representative Mobley?
Okay. Fine, thank you.
Thank you. Representative McNeil?
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Geist. I appreciate it. I just have a quick question on your chart here, which I'm sure you can clear up. Under Deputy Commissioner Tim Moose, you have a Director of Security Services,
yes.
TBD, which apparently is an open position. But that seems to be a dead end. That block doesn't go anywhere. Could you explain what that person's job is, who yes. answers to him or whatever?
Thank you very much. It's a great question. It is a vacant position. It is not one that has been created per se. Security services, prior to me becoming commissioner, we had security services in prisons, and we had security services in community correction. I've gotten folks out of silos. So now, and I thought the security service piece, which basically helps us with the gang issues, identifying gang issues, et cetera, in our facilities and out in the community, and we have the same security service issues, gang issues in prison, in juvenile justice also, because, as you well know, we've got those types of issues. This security service position, we've taken folks out from under community correction and out from under Division of Prisons, and we've created a position that works at a high level with us to help us deal with those issues, and also works closely with law enforcement in the community, because what we have learned for years is that we have a wealth of knowledge because of information we receive right within inside the prison system that needs to be shared with law enforcement to help us address not only gang issues but other types of issues that we face out in our community. So that position has been one that we have taken from prisons and brought to this location, and it does actually have people under them. We just didn't draw. If I drew all the boxes under all of these, we would need a very wide sheet. This is just kind of the nuts and bolts, and we tried to add in the sections that related to juvenile justice where it fit together. But security service is a very important piece for us. But it's no new positions. It's positions we already have.
Thank you. Representative Faircloth, Guilford. Thank you. Representative Hurley.
We have time.
Okay. Mary Jennings, do you have a question? I'm at the end of the line. Okay. You have a... Yeah, well, we're on that. Yeah. Anything else you'd like to add?
Not about that.
Okay.
Trying to remember, I'm supposed to get finished quickly.
Well, that's what you said an hour ago, Dave. We will address the automobiles at next oversight. We'd like to put it on. That's so you'll be prepared. Also, if you talk about Dobbs, the YDC kitchen update, please.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me just touch on this, and then you can ask me some questions. Again, this is early for us. And I say it's early for us simply because we've been at this a month or so trying to understand clearly the expectations of the legislature and the expectations of what we might need to do in the future. But there's, and I'm not going to go over the history. All I want to indicate to you, the Dobbs facility, the population there, actual population today is 43. I think the Dobbs capacity is for about 250. Now, I have not been to Dobbs, but I understand that we have 43 young people there at this time. I also understand the national best practices would indicate a facility like that should have about 90. So I'm not making any kind of judgments here. I'm just indicating to you that the kitchen area at that facility is that needs to be renovated is about 7,200 square feet. So it's a large kitchen facility. And in estimating a cost for that kitchen facility, our folks from engineers spent the time necessary to go in and look at renovating that 7,200 square foot kitchen. And if you renovate that square foot kitchen, and then renovations, the estimate's based on about $200 a square foot, I believe, for renovations, would come out to about $1.8 million, somewhere closer to $1.8 million, to renovate that facility. Now, right now what we're doing is we're utilizing at the behest of the body here, utilizing the kitchen across the street at Lenore, and Lenore is the facility that we closed. And the food's being prepared there and being brought over. Now, the food is not, we're not serving the food in the dining hall area. We're actually serving the food in the day room areas because you've got a small population and we're able to do that. It's my understanding that the Office of State Budgeting has approved, and it should be coming over to GovOps here shortly, this request for the $1.8 million to make this project occur. And I know there's some questions and concerns about that. And I guess what I want to talk with you about just briefly is that we do have four YDCs in North Carolina. And you know, we've closed some, and you've done that just recently. And I want to talk with you a little bit about our population today over the YDCs. The population today is 221. We have 221 kids in youth development centers today. The overall available beds at those four locations is 309. I can give you the breakdown of each one. It's at Dillon, Dobbs, Stonewall, and Chatham. But I don't know that I need to do that. I think you just need to understand that we've got those kind of beds available, and that's the population. And I'm sure it'll swing up and down somewhat. The real question is, when you look at spending $1.7 million to renovate a kitchen that the square footage is as large as it is, and you've got 45 folks there, what is the real intention as we move forward? What kind of long-term plan do we have in place to address these issues? And then keeping in mind what the national requirements are. And I just honestly need a little time to be able to evaluate and make a recommendation as it relates to what we should do. Now, are there other alternatives that could be considered? One, I think we could continue to use the kitchen at across the street at Lenore for a period of time. Continue to do that. If you ask me to search hard, I probably would also tell you that we have an adult facility not too far from that. That if we wanted to bring food in from the adult facility, I think it's about 15 miles or so away. We probably could do that. We wouldn't even have considered that a year, you know, a few months back. But that's something that could be considered or looked at. Just until we get a handle on this situation, or we could come in and we could renovate a smaller portion or build a smaller kitchen there at Dobbs. I will tell you there is a difference in, it's my understanding, there's a difference in a new construction. If we were going to build something new there, it's about $400 a square foot. And some would say, well, why in the world does it cost that much? Believe me, when you've got things at an older facility where you've got lead paint and you've got other types of issues, asbestos, et cetera, you've got to take care of all of those things, and putting in the infrastructure and those things, I think that's all factored in and figured in as to why it cost what it cost. Now, I've got my engineer here. He's the one that can tell you about the nuts and the bolts and all that kind of stuff if you want to get into detail. But my suggestion is let's look at some of these alternatives that we have, because unless we're planning to expand Dobbs, and maybe we are, I don't know, but if we are, then we need to spend that $1.7 million on that kitchen at that facility. But if potentially there's another way to go, I would say, I'd ask the question, should we spend that $1.7 million at this point? So that's pretty much it.
Representative McNeil.
That's one powerful kitchen that takes 7,200 square feet. That's enough for about seven kitchens.
My golden corral back home, I don't think is that big.
Yeah, I don't really see why 7,200 square feet. I don't see why you couldn't just renovate 1,000 or 1,500 square foot of that facility and instead of 7,200, because I'm very familiar. I think you said there's 43 inmates there now, and it will only hold how many? What was it? The maximum?
The maximum, according to What we looked at earlier today was 200 and I think 250 for that facility. However, I think that number was something that was pulled before we looked at national, the recognition nationally of how many you would have at a particular or a size facility, which is about 90. But again, when people give me data, I want to do more than just look at the data. I want to analyze the data. But I think you're exactly right as it relates to the square footage. Now, you and I both know when I'm talking about kitchen facility, I'm talking about dining room, et cetera, and nobody's going to have a 7,200-square-foot kitchen. I was in the restaurant business 20 years, so we're not going to do that. But you still got all that infrastructure. What I understand about the building, it has a relatively new roof. But other than that, it's in poor repair. So there's got a lot of repairs got to be done to that building itself, which would take care of the dining experience plus the kitchen area. But I'm game for whatever we come up with as it relates to the facility. I mean, that's
Representative Neal.
Yeah, follow up. And I understand what you're saying that the 7,200 square feet includes not only the kitchen but the dining hall. And I'm not 100% for sure how the facility is laid out. I know you say right now that you're feeding them in their quarters. I'm not sure why that just couldn't continue, why you couldn't just renovate a part of that 7,200 square feet for a kitchen and continue to feed them in their quarters.
Yes, sir.
Or their day rooms or whatever.
I think those are legitimate questions that need to be looked at and answered. Again, as I mentioned when I started this presentation, I think what would be important for me is to have the time that's necessary to look closely and analyze the facilities that we have and look closely at the history of how many folks that we've had in these facilities, what their capacity is. There's a lot of issues that relate to if you've got a facility and you could have separate areas that you could house, but your core for that, in the core I'm talking about, dining facilities, medical, storage, all of those kinds of things, your training rooms, et cetera, that's your core for a facility. There's different ways of looking at it. I haven't had that opportunity, but I'm going quickly to begin looking at some of these facilities and ask those questions. But again, it's my understanding that I think the oversight or the GovOps committee pretty soon will be looking at this request for $1.7 million, and that's what we're
I think what I'm hearing is that you're asking this committee to give you a little bit more time to reevaluate the facility to because I do have concern at $1.8 million for a kitchen area, 7,200. And I do know in past discussions there have been discussions of whether closing this facility, and it was recommended of the DPS not to because of the vocational, educational components to this particular campus versus the Lenore campus, which was closed, which was a newer facility. I'm hearing you asking for a little bit more time, maybe till January, to report back to us, or?
Well, I am asking you for some time. I would like to ask you for more than just January. Just because
you run a restaurant, you know we got to make decisions.
I know you do, sir. but it's hunting season too.
And we got
March would work well if I could get back to you in March. I believe we could have a plan for you, and maybe to be honest with you, not just look at this facility, but look at our facilities, assess our facilities, see what those needs are across the board and come back with a report.
Representative Hurley, you'd like to comment or Representative Faircloth?
Did we put a mandate on you to move forward with this? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, sir.
You didn't put one on me, but you put one on somebody.
I think it was October of this year. Or is that correct? Yeah, Christine Leggett addressed the issue, or Lisa Fox.
Hi, Lisa Fox. Yes, the mandate, the special provision mandated the kitchen be finished by October 1st.
That ain't going to happen.
Can we go a week there, Dave?
That ain't going to happen. Well, like I said, it just took over, so.
I understand it, and I guess what I'm asking, if it's the will of the committee, Representative Senator Daniels, I'm sorry, do you have a comment?
I have a separate question.
Okay. Let's kind of get this issue resolved here. Is there a motion?
I move
or can we do a motion?
I'm sorry, you can certainly do a motion.
Okay, hold up a minute.
Mr. Chair, I think that you could certainly do a motion that's saying, you know, you support the commissioner's new plan. But the October 1 deadline was a law that was passed by all 170 members of the General Assembly. So y'all cannot, as a body, as a JPS oversight body, counterman that law. You can't say, well, you can just ignore it. You can certainly hear their reports and listen to why they have not been able to comply with the law. But do you see what I'm saying? So, and it sounds like what Commissioner Geis is asking is that y'all allow him to March or April to come back with a report on all the juvenile justice facilities and what their long-term plan is going to be for those facilities. There's never been a 5 or 10 year long-term plan for juvenile justice facilities. So to have the department provide that to you at this time is actually kind of would be a very good thing.
I'd have to look at the specific statute, but I don't believe that the statute may include what the ramifications would be if they did not. So absent anything in the statute that says what happens if they didn't meet a deadline, yes, it's a direction, but if it's not met, then it would be in the purview of this oversight committee to decide what to do at that point. So, again, I would say a motion would be in order based upon the reasons and the basis for the departments not meeting that deadline, what the commission would recommend.
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that the desire to accomplish this task is one that we very much are interested in being successful with. However, there was no funding set aside to accomplish this task when the directive was given. In addition to that, we have gone through the closures and have completed those closures as required by the legislature, and I believe we were allowed to continue to operate the food operation out of the closed facility across the street. But in order to get this project up and going, one, we had to have the engineers go in and tell us exactly what it would cost, and I don't know that anyone up to this point has looked at the fact that that 7,000 square foot room is actually set up to serve 250 people, and we only have 45 people there. So, you know, what I'm wanting to do is ensure that we're doing the right thing. And I'm concerned, even if this goes to the GovOps committee, that all of a sudden someone will pass an initiative for $1.8 million when there's a real question about what we might do with the facility in the future. I think that is of great concern. So we in no way are trying to ignore the directive. It's just about impossible. We had to find the funding, and we're going through the proper channels to get the funding, but naturally they've not even met to approve the funding yet for the project, so there's no way it could be done, and I'm not exactly sure how long it would take if we had the funding. If I might ask.
Mr. Pell, if you could give us some direction at this point.
Again, I would say it's up to the committee to determine what they would move be done in this situation. If there are certain variables that aren't known, it wouldn't be until the General Assembly met again that any other action could be taken. But this committee could adopt a motion for whatever action they think is appropriate under the circumstances.
Senator Bryant.
Well, I was happy to make a motion. I'm not sure what the sentiments are, but my sentiments are that we should ask that our chairs, support even asking GovOps, asking whoever might be involved, the secretary, GovOps, et cetera, to postpone consideration of this whole matter until March, until more work could, I don't know how commissioner would feel about that, until more of the background work can be done and everyone move forward on one accord in fulfilling the mandates of the statute. And then even in March, if we find that there are more concerns, we could then say we should hope that it be reviewed in May if they can maintain the status quo. That's just my thinking, but I'm happy to help make a motion meet the sentiment of the, of everybody.
The statutes we discussed this morning about the organization and the role of the committee provides that this committee has the authority to report to the General Assembly at any time, including the interim, and also to recommend legislation, specific legislation. So it may be appropriate to do that, and during the course of that, develop whatever legislation may be deemed appropriate after that's done, and then provide that to the General Assembly in the short session.
Okay. Would you like to clarify Senator Bryant's motion?
Yeah, could you make a suggestion? I mean, we can either make a suggestion that staff look at it and propose something to us for the next meeting, if that would be in time. I'm just concerned about somebody going to GovOps and approving this $1 million without more thought. So that worries me more than what may be happening here. So whatever would empower our leadership to, on our behalf, to pursue maintaining the status quo until at least March, if that's the sentiment of the commissioner. Is that generally what you would support?
Yeah, Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in agreement. I think what this committee should do is, first of all, acknowledge the report, a timely report to us on this particular required construction, what have you, so that it's recognized for the record that it was reported to us, and then that we ask that the commissioner report back or the department report back to us in March on further findings at that point or further information, at which time we could then consider some recommendation to the General Assembly.
Thank you, Chairwoman Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I also would like to have in that motion, too, because of the findings of the paint, the paint, lead paint, as well as the asbestos, which would definitely make it very more expensive to do this, and if it can be done as we're doing now, the status quo, I certainly agree with this.
Thank you. Senator Bryant, if you'd like to go ahead.
Do we want any interface with, do we want our chairs to notify GovOps of our concern, or we don't feel
well,
like
that's what
our
your motion's going to.
Okay, but I didn't hear that. I want to make sure that's all right with fair. Okay, so I make a motion that we document, if just for the formality of it, that we have received a report of the commissioner in accordance with, in due time, around the issue as provided in the statute, whatever the proper wording is, that we ask he come back in March with more information and any proposals that that would be appropriate at that time on how to address this issue, and authorize our chairs to take whatever action is appropriate to communicate to GovOps our concern about moving forward on this issue in a funding fashion without further information.
Yeah, based
Those
on
three
the fact,
things,
right? Based on the fact that GovOps has not met and approved the funding,
right? Yes.
And also, we need to give him the authority to keep Lenore open.
Yes.
To
that would be the fourth thing, and that he'd be given the authority to maintain the status quo from whatever source. So those four things. Is that
Mr. Chair, I just want to throw out GovOps is meeting on October 29th, and the R&R for the Dobbs Kitchen is on one of the many R&R items that y'all will be considering at that time. So I don't know how that fits in with what you're trying to do now, but just so you're aware, this item is scheduled to be heard on.
I think what the motion is for them to pull that item.
Well, for our chairs to make to notify them
that they need to pull the item, that they did not meet the statutory date of October. Upon further discussion with DPS and Commissioner Geis. For an overall review of the YDC facilities, to come back with a 5-year plan or a temporary plan in March to continue, but also the ability to give him the authority to continue with Lenore to feed the children of Dobbs.
So that would be number 4, would be the authority to maintain the status quo. You have even beefed up my GovOps provision, which would be to ask you to ask them to pull that item if they would, out of respect for our desire to, in our oversight role, to continue to look at the matter in March, whatever way. I so move.
Second, Representative McNeil. Any further discussion? Any staff? Are we okay?
Yes, sir. The statutes say you can report to the General Assembly, and I think a report, or however you want to do that, to the GovOps Commission is well within the authority.
Okay. We have a motion. We have a second. All in favor? Aye. All opposed? I think the ayes have it. Commissioner Geis, I will give you the last 60-minute close-up.
60 minutes? Good.
hold a minute, please. I'm sorry. Senator Daniel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is more of a comment and perhaps a request of the chairs. As the committee is probably aware, the legislature mandated that the department close approximately 10 facilities in prison facilities across the state. That particularly concerned me because the largest one was in my district, which would result theoretically in about the loss of 325 jobs and then a vacant building, you know, that's worth millions and millions of dollars. So I guess I would ask the chairs to consider at a future meeting having the department report back about what are we doing to mothball these buildings, or what are we doing? Because some of these facilities were actually fairly new, from my understanding, and I know the department has also sort of pledged aggressive efforts to try to reposition the employees who are RIFed into other positions that are vacant. So I'd like to personally see, just across all these facilities, what they're planning to do with the asset itself, and then what success have they had in placing the RIFT employees, whether within their department or within other, you know, state agencies.
And I agree, and I think that's something that I would like for Commissioner Geis, as far as the RIFT employees, if he would like to answer today, and if he can have a report back at next meeting, your concerns on the assets. But I think the employees are a priority question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very proud to stand before you today to tell you that we have closed all facilities, prison facilities that we were legislatively asked to close other than Western at this point. We were asked to close 5 facilities, and we have closed 4 of those facilities. In the case of employees, all employees at all 4 facilities that were closed that wanted a job were offered a job and that are working today. We're very proud of that. In addition to that, at Western Youth, the report I got this morning, we have 259 persons that need a job at this point. 259, because as you remember, a portion of our employees from that facility were going to be transferred to the facility right down the road to assist us at that location and a portion of those will be going there. And there's been some folks that have left employment with the department and sought employment other locations. But of the 259 persons that we're looking for jobs and we've been meeting with staff, we have identified 214 positions that we can place those folks in. So we are 45 positions short at this point, and we still have a couple of months, I believe, before we close the facility that we're going to continue to work on. Now, the employees have not been notified yet, and that's part of the process where our group goes in after they meet with them initially and listen to their concerns and talk with them and try to match up years of service and what might be available. They're going to be going back and doing that shortly. But we have identified 214 positions that we can place those folks in. We've been holding positions in community corrections, probation positions. We've been holding other positions that are available at other facilities. Not everybody will work as close to their home as before. Some will have to drive a further distance. We understand that. But these, we feel like, is going to turn out to be an okay situation, if there can be an okay situation. So we're here to report that we've been able to, I think we'll be able at the end of the day to place a large majority of the staff, even at Western, at a location. I'll also say to you that we are working diligently on identifying facilities that have closed. It's not just this year that facilities have closed. Over the years, we have closed a lot of facilities. They were small facilities, and they are arrangements have been made and worked through the process. The first thing that we have to do is we have to, as a department, determine whether or not we want to use that facility for some other use, if there's a use for it. Then after that, we have to allow other state agencies to look and see if they have a use for that facility. And then after that, of course, during this process, when we move out and we move our equipment out and cut the lights and water off, then that facility is turned over to engineering, and engineering takes control of the facility there and then begins working through the process that they have to work through, and they receive calls from counties and private folks and other folks that might be interested in the facilities. There's a process that has to be worked through that will actually eventually go to the Council of State Government to look at and make a decision as it relates to what's going to happen with that facility. Why, in the past, we might have sold a facility for $1. I can tell you a facility up in Mecklenburg County that sits near the airport up there with two beautiful motels on either side is not going to go for $1. So it depends on what actually occurs and maybe some commitment that's been made in the past. So we're in the process all the time of doing that. I will be glad to come back for this committee at a later time and bring a report. In fact, I will be meeting tomorrow with some of my staff to identify all the spaces that are still out there and what's going on. There are a couple of facilities that we have kept the electricity and water on because we felt like there was a need possibly to repurpose those in some way, or they could be used by the department in some way. And it's much easier when you don't cut the electricity and water off to get something done later on. So we're looking at those facilities also. But we will have a report for the committee.
Thank you. Senator Daniel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Commissioner, for that information.
Anyone else? Commissioner Geis.
I'm through. Thank you very much.
I would just like to say that you have undertaken a large task of this state of North Carolina, and if I am correct, your department, DPS and all, is the largest employer the largest state agency that we have, and this committee is tasked to that largest facility. I've met with your staff on several occasions, very professional. I will say yesterday's tour was very nice and enlightening. Warden Harris is very committed to this state and to the system, and I wish the other committee members would have been there. I think it was just real good. I can't imagine what you've been going through with closures. We went back home after we told you what to do, and we started back to our work, but your work just started. And I think you're still trying to figure out what we did to you. But I commend you for what you have done so far. I think the state of North Carolina has got a great asset in a North Carolina native, and I commend you. And I thank you for what you do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairs, if you have any closing comments, Senator Goolsbee.
Again, I would just encourage all the members and the public that's still here to please let us hear from you. Christine has told me that, as we requested last time when we had the Oversight Committee, all of this is being recorded. It will be loaded up on the website. As you've probably seen, all the documents we've discussed today will be loaded there, are already there, and we'll do that in every committee meeting and try to get them loaded up before. I believe I'm going to be in charge of our next committee meeting, and if you have any suggestions about things you'd like us to look at on oversight, I'm all ears. Please do email those to me. And, Mr. Chair, if you could recognize one of the representatives. Thank you.
Graham. Representative Graham.
Thank you, sir. For the next meeting, and I'm just bringing this up because it came to my attention today, as a news article, there's an agency that's been contracted with for North Carolina, state of North Carolina, to handle inmates' funds that are going to them from their family member. I'd like to get some more information on that and how that came about and who's responsible for that and how that all evolved.
That's fine. Thank you. Representative Hurley, Randolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, thank you all for being here today. And we do want to go on other trips out in the communities to see what we are overseeing. So I hope that more of you will be able to go next time because it is very enlightening and we are making decisions that affect these lives. Thank you.
I would also like to remind you all that everybody, does everyone get reports?
Yes, sir, they're all online.
I know, but do they get them? Okay. Would you like to talk about that? These are reports that are submitted on behalf of the Highway Patrol of the seizure money, where they spend it at, report on public safety training, youth development annual report, and...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, all of the reports that are to go to oversight are posted on your committee website. I sent an email out to yesterday or 2 days ago with a link. If you have problems accessing any of those reports, or if you want us just to send you the reports directly, we can do that. Just let us know. There's all of the reports are on there in PDF format, and then there's also an Excel spreadsheet on there that just has a list of the reports that have come in.
Okay, and also if you have any ideas, I think we're interested in the state crime lab, DOC facilities again, and any other things that you're interested in, just please let us know. Anything else good for the committee?
We made it 4 hours.
We may next time try to meet maybe at 10 or 11, but as you can see, we've got a lot to go over. And it may be that we meet, maybe twice a month. But we have a lot. This is a large agency. And there's a lot of questions. And it's like the concerns of the automobiles that our probation officers do not have. And those are things that we just need to find out and not just keep putting on down and wait until we get back in May. So I thank you for your time. Hope everybody has a safe travel home. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.